Hey everybody, welcome to the Real DMC Podcast. Just wanted to give you a quick editor's note up front. As we were discussing the 2021 version of Dune, one of the themes that came up was, could you actually understand this movie if you have not read the book, seen the Lynch version, or had any other point of reference? And after Colin, Marcus, and I watched the film, it turns out that my mom, dad, and aunt got together to watch it as well. And as I referenced during the podcast, my mom sent me a text saying, and I'll quote, "We're trying to watch Dune, ... It's not going well." So I decided to test our theory by conducting a quick interview with my mom. Not surprisingly, we ended up with different opinions about the film. I actually thought she did surprisingly well with the plot, but I became a little suspicious when she started referencing things that had not actually happened in the movie, but did happen in the Dune timeline. For example, Paul drinking the water of life. And it turns out that my mom actually woke up extra early to read Wikipedia, because she wanted to get herself informed, because she didn't want to disappoint me on the podcast. Thanks for going the extra mile with your Dune studies, Mom, even if it's cheating a little bit. Love you, Mom. Thanks for being a good sport. If you'd like to jump directly to the conversation I have with my mom, it's around the hour and 53 mark. Just want to say we're having a blast with this podcast, so thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the episode. Thank you.
Who's ready to talk Dune?
Who's ready to talk the 2021 version of Dune?
Oh, yeah.
Let's do that.
The spice must flow!
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Real DMC Podcast. DMC stands for Dave, Marks, and Colin. Guys, it's been a while since we've been here potting. You remember how to do this?
No.
Not really.
Wait, did we ever know how to do this?
We are seeing lots of ongoing listening or increases in our listenership, I should say.
Especially in Norway.
Well, I'm going to talk about that in a second. But we would love to get some feedback. You can send a message to feedback@realdmc.com, and you can find us on Twitter @realdmc. And as Marcus just referenced, strangely, we are seeing growth in our international charts, which is kind of fun to watch. The place where we've had the most significant jump is in Norway, of all places. We would love to hear from one of our Norwegian listeners out there as to, you know, what are you guys listening to? Because we have not done a Norwegian film that I'm aware of. So let me try this. So what I would like to say to our Norwegian listeners is, Tusen takk, så hyggelig lav deg, which I believe is a thank you. And if I instead insulted you with my pronunciation, my apologies.
Oh, I thought that translated to, no, we are not Run DMC.
No, I did not. I did not try the Norwegian version of that. We thought it'd be fun to actually begin providing brief snippets of feedback, either in the form of reviews or messages sent to us. So, two quick comments.
Is this the time for our 360 review? I didn't know we were doing that live.
I'm gonna review Marcus.
Let me get my Colin notes out.
I have extensive notes for both you guys, so we'll have to take this offline. One quick comment from a Purdy, who said, "Finally listened to your Tango and Cash episode. LOL. That was short and to the point, and we appreciate it. Our Tango and Cash episode is a pretty fun one if you want to go back and just see what it's like when we're taking apart a bad movie, so I'd recommend that." And then we also received a message from Richard, who said, "Your Halloween Kills pod was tons of fun. I was super curious what you guys were going to say about the ending. I guess you guys are as confused as the rest of us." I thought that was fun, yeah. And if you listen to the Halloween Kills pod, which was the last pod that we did, or actually no, because we will launch Starship Troopers by the time I say that's how we roll this out. So scratch that. But that was a fun pod, and for whatever reason, it kind of took off and became our most listened to podcast. That's fun, and thank you for the ongoing listenership. It's tons of fun watching the numbers grow.
I believe that Norwegians love Halloween Kills.
Today, we're here to discuss... Colin, we're here to discuss the 2021 version directed by Denis Villeneuve, Dune.
My planet Arrakis is so beautiful when the sun is low. Rolling over the sands, you can see spice in the air. The outsiders ravage our lands in front of our eyes. Their cruelty to my people is all I've known.
We are House Atreides. There is no call we do not answer. There is no faith that we betray.
Smile, Gurney.
I am smiling.
The Emperor asks us to bring peace to Arrakis.
House Atreides accepts!
The Duke's son sees too much.
This is Idun. Kill them all.
God in heaven.
I'm waiting for you to come back and say, I'd rather talk about the Lynch version.
No, we did a whole podcast on that. I'm here to talk about the book version.
Yes, we do have a previous Dune podcast. We actually did it about a year ago, and it was in preparation for the release of this film. If you want to hear more about the Lynch version in detail, I'd recommend you go back and listen to the previous podcast. If you want to hear more about the 2021 version, you're in the right place, hopefully, if we can keep Colin on track, because Colin, here's the thing, straight up at the top, I think you prefer the Lynch version to this one. Is that correct?
Yes and no.
So explain yourself on that, because I know that you ride hard for the Lynch version, but I do not think that the general population would be aligned with your view on this.
I think you're wrong. I think that there's a huge audience out there who love that movie. I think it's attained cult status.
The problem is that they're all 60 and 70 years old.
Well, maybe some of them are 50. But I love it. These are two very different movies based on the same source material. And because of that, I love them both. Well, I don't know if I love them both. I do love the Lynch version. I do have a fond affection for the Villeneuve version. I would like to discuss both of them a little bit. They both have different positives. That's why I can't really pick one. If you forced me to pick one, I'd pick 1984, because it's been with me now for 35 years. And I do love that movie, but I really like this movie a lot.
So does the general population. By way of introduction, the film does maintain an 8.2 rating on the IMDb. That's actually pretty high. That must be probably bumping up against the top 100 rated movies on there, I would imagine.
That's very high. Anything above an 8 is really good.
By comparison, the Lynch version maintains a 6.4 rating, and the sci-fi miniseries actually maintains a 7.0 rating. I do recall watching that series and actually being pretty impressed with it. So I know it's lower budget, so obviously you don't have the scope of something like what we have with the 2021 version. But I do recall watching that and thinking it was pretty good. Did you guys ever see it?
I did not. And now I want to see it, and I actively tried to go out and get it, but apparently it's not available anywhere. I tried to buy the discs on Amazon, and I think it was like they were selling for like $584.
Really?
It's very rare, apparently. I think the fact that it was Sci-Fi Network, it sort of put me off to it.
I can understand that. So you have to probably marinate in the lower budget to accept it. I forget how long it was, 6 hours long or something like that. I can't remember.
I think it might have been three or four.
But it was multiple hours.
Okay.
But it seems like it at least gave it enough time to showcase the material and get into it a little bit deeper. And I do think that's one of the advantages of the 2021 version of Dune, because sure, it only films the first half of the book, but I think it actually gives time to unpack everything that's in the book, because it's a super dense book for sure.
I think they needed more time. A much longer series would do a lot more justice, I think. I would love to see a Game of Thrones type. I mean, it's not going to happen now with the movies, but a Game of Thrones treatment, multiple seasons going over the world in the series, I think it'd be really cool.
I mean, I would just love to see a miniseries. Oh, wait, we just talked about that.
Like a high budget
exactly.
One?
If this was a Netflix limited series, yeah. That would be fantastic.
Yeah, they could do 10 hours on just the first book, and I think it would have been done much, much better. Or a lot less confusing.
What was the budget for this movie?
$165 million.
Yeah, it was $165 million, and so far it's made $102 million at the U.S. domestic box office and another $300 million worldwide. So after this weekend, it'll probably be over $400 million. And there was lots of controversy in terms of the release. Denis Villeneuve was actually quite pissed off at the Warner Brothers decision to do the HBO Max release.
Well, he's probably not the only one. I was reading the review by Anthony Lane in the New Yorker. He was really impressed initially by just the scale of the film.
Right.
And he said, nice plan, guys. It's like trying to stuff a cornfield into a cereal box.
It's funny because I have not seen this movie on the big screen as of yet, but I've watched the movie several times and I've watched several sequences within the movie 10 or 15 times because I'm quite taken with this movie, surprisingly. I have no investment in the source material. I read the books a long time ago. I like the Lynch film, but, and this is going to sound pretentious, I think this movie is visual poetry for two reasons, right? I think it's incredibly beautiful. There are so many shots in this movie that just kind of blow me away. And I also think that it could be, like a poem, hard to understand. This is the big question I have about this movie. And it's funny because I thought about maybe interviewing my parents, because I got a text from my mom. The first one was, "We're trying to watch Dune right now." And then a couple seconds later, "It's not going well." That's what she sent back to me.
Well, let me first just start by saying, Dave, you pretentious fuck.
Thank you.
No, I totally agree with you. It is a beautiful, stunning film.
My nephew, he watched Dune on his phone.
On his phone.
On his phone.
Jesus Christ. So that was his experience. What is wrong with that generation?
Wait, who's the filmmaker? Was it Fincher?
No, it was Lynch.
Oh, no, Lynch. He said,
"It's such a sadness that you think you've seen a film on your fucking telephone. Get real."
Yeah, Lynch is right about that. Very much like Independence Day, scale is the thing that comes again and again in terms of the visualization that makes this movie so impressive. You know, the interstellar travel, the huge ships landing again and again and again, I just think the scale is used to great effect and produces some amazing visuals. This movie blew me away, honestly. Like, I have not been affected by a movie as much as this in a long time.
Yeah, I agree with the scale. It was really cool to see the, I don't know what those were, like warm, like tunnels or wormholes or something in space.
Yeah.
So you see the tiny little ships coming out of there and it looks like just a dot on the screen.
Those are the Guild spacecraft.
Yeah. But like, it looks like it's a wormhole connected somewhere else, right? So from that view, you see the little tiny ships in space. And then when they're landing on the planet, you see
they're massive, huge.
Playing with scale there was really,
well, this is
really
the
well
thing
done.
I think, which is sort of the forte of Denis Villeneuve, right? His movies are very somber with immense scale. To me, they lack a bit of joy.
That's funny. I was reading a review by Glenn Kenny from RogerEbert.com, and his quote was, "Villeneuve has been and likely remains one of the most humorless filmmakers alive."
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Like, I really sort of wish that this movie had a little bit of spark of joy, and it doesn't. The Lynch movie does. It has a lot of that. It's got a lot of weirdness, too. But I just...
Intentional?
Wait.
Where's the joy in the Lynch version?
Well, joy, maybe it sparks joy in me, but it's energy. There's a lot of... It does!
Yeah, I don't recall a lot of happy moments, like when Harkonnens are ripping out heart plugs and stuff, right? Or Raban is pressing a squioid down and then drinking the juice. That's joyful.
I revel in its weirdness.
To be fair, the Herbert book isn't that light. It's a pretty dense and pretty hard science fiction novel. So there's not that levity in there anyways.
No. I'm not saying that that Dune itself is full of joy. I just feel like the movie needs energy.
I mean, that's why Star Wars was so successful and things like this were not, right?
This movie, I love it as well. Like I said, it's beautiful. But it's sort of like going on a visit to the museum. Your breath is taken away by these masterpieces, but everyone's very quiet. No talking in the museum.
Dave's comparison to poetry.
Yeah, I think you're dead on there.
Very poetic, yeah.
I mean, look at Arrival. Very similar in certain aspects.
So what do you think about Villeneuve then, I guess, in general?
I like him. The thing, though, is that his films are just somber.
It's interesting because I really love Arrival, and I think Arrival is actually pretty amazing, at least in terms of the scale and the visuals again. You know, some of his other movies I don't necessarily really love. I did not love Blade Runner 2049. I thought it was a very beautiful movie, but that one to me feels very cold and very dispassionate. Sicario, I think, is a really well-made movie, but it's not a movie that I enjoy. I don't like that movie.
Oh, really?
It's too dark and depressing for me, honestly.
I like it.
I like that one a lot.
I like it a lot. Yeah. I watched it the second time. I was just hooked. It was so great.
His ability to command visuals as a director is unparalleled right now, at least in terms of the big tentpole stuff. Honestly, if he made a movie that was just 45 minutes of sandworms doing shit in the desert, I would watch that movie and I would be captivated. I would be utterly captivated.
Hans Zimmer music to that and you're good?
Oh, fuck yeah. And then I'll take some spice and just watch it.
Well, there's part two. again, I look at this film from the context of the David Lynch film. But I also reread the book and I watched the movie at the same time. And what I really noticed was that it seemed like he purposely did not take a lot of lines of dialogue from the book, because if he had done that, it would have been like way too similar to David Lynch's movie. The inner dialogue, the inner monologue that the characters have in the 84 version.
Right.
A lot of that is really, really good stuff. I mean, it's lifted directly from the book. I think it helps to explain a lot. And he did not do that here. And I think maybe to the detriment of the audience understanding some of the things that are going on. And they try to explain it in different ways. But I completely understand why he wouldn't do it, because you would just be like 84 all over again.
Right.
Without all the weirdness.
I watched it with my wife and we ended up stopping it, I don't know, 9 times to explain what's going on.
9 times.
9 times.
9 times.
It definitely needs more explanation of what and why. It throws a lot at you without explaining who the people are or why they're doing it or motivations. There's a lot of very, very confusing stuff early on. And maybe it gets explained throughout, but barely.
I think this movie is very uncompromising.
Yeah.
You either kind of are on board just to experience it, or you are familiar with the original material and you know what's going on. I don't think that this movie goes out of its way to try to spoon feed you or provide, truthfully, maybe enough exposition if you are unfamiliar with it. Because I can't imagine trying to watch this movie if you hadn't read the book or seen the Lynch version. What I was thinking about might be an interesting way to do this would be just go watch the intro on the Lynch version, just the first 5 minutes of the Lynch version, and then tune into this one. And I think you would have a better ride.
Yeah, the first 5 minutes is pretty dense.
You really sort of need that, though. You need that history. Villeneuve chose not to do that. There are a lot of scenes that are very, very close to the book. Overall, I think this movie, 2021, is a lot more faithful to the book. Not to say that the 84 version wasn't going to be, but they cut the shit out of it. Yeah, I feel like if you're a book reader, you're going to love this movie. And if you're not, you're just going to be very confused.
I guess the question would be, is if you were going in cold, or you were doing an experiment, right? 10 people that weren't familiar with Dune in one room and 10 people in the other. You showed them the Lynch version and you showed them this version. And then you ask them a bunch of questions, like a questionnaire afterwards. What is the spice? Who are the Bene Gesserit? What's the Kwisatz Haderach? Here you go. One last question.
Oh, no.
What is the Kwisatz Haderach?
Oh, come on. Stop it.
What is the Kwisatz Haderach?
I have not a clue.
Who do you think is going to score better? Who's going to get closer?
I think Lynch. Yeah.
Oddly.
You might be right on that one, actually.
Yeah.
That was the one thing. Like, if you were to take the original script version of Dune. What did we say? Like, there was a 4-hour version floating out there somewhere. I bet that would have been more faithful to the book and you would have had a better understanding of what was going on than the Villeneuve version. But the Villeneuve version looks freaking amazing. It's also 35 years later. And then if you just took a little bit of the weirdness from, from Lynch, you would have like the perfect movie.
I don't think you need the weird. Way I would perfect the movie is I would take out a lot of the mythology and just make it a modern sci-fi movie without so much religion and without so much of the kind of backstory.
How, though? That's a huge theme in the book.
You're not going to be true to the book, but that's what's going to make it a popular movie.
Right? Yeah, see, I 100% disagree.
I'm not saying it's going to be better or not. I'm just saying, like, if you want to make it
a broadly accepted piece of IP.
Yeah.
Here's what would happen if you did that. All the book people would...
Well, they would hate it.
They would hate it, and they wouldn't watch it. And then it critically, it just would have gotten like, yeah, it's kind of an okay movie. Like, it's basically an action movie, and it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. It would have been nothing.
It'd be the equivalent of an Avengers-type movie, and you'd make millions more
dollars,
right?
I don't think it would.
I think it would top out, for sure.
I think it would have been like a $165 million flop.
No. I think it would have done much, much better. I think that's where it's topping out now. It's just tapping into the market that already love it. The people who are interested are watching it saying, yeah, don't bother. It's beautiful, but confusing.
We can send this over to the Mentats for them to come up with a final decision for us.
Yeah. I'm not saying it's a better movie if you do that. I'm just saying that's what would make it a popular movie. Easier to follow as you just strip out a lot of the confusing parts of it. To tell the story, you don't need all of that part.
No, I think you do.
I think you completely kneecap the significance of this movie if you do that. I actually think that the fact that it is so uncompromising and it is so beautiful and it tackles all of the difficult shit head on is what makes it so great.
No, you kneecap the book, but the movie would actually be, it'd just be a different story to some degree. It'd be taking inspiration from the book.
No.
I could not disagree more.
I understand what you're saying. I think this is a better, I enjoy this one better. I wouldn't want to see the other one.
Yeah.
If you want to explain the story, you just have to not try to explain. There's just too much in it.
If you want to explain the story, you just have to try not to explain it.
Exactly. You remove the complicated parts of the story.
No. And here's the analog, Game of Thrones. You do like just what you said.
Well, yeah, that's
just the, what you, yeah. You have to make it into like an HBO or Netflix miniseries or something like that. Then you'd have all that spaciousness that you need in order to really explain the story and all the intricacies of the plot. And
you can't cover the whole 10,000 year breeding program in one like quick walkthrough. One short conversation.
The Game of Thrones comparison is interesting because it's also an example of them limiting what they put on the screen in relation to the book, right? Because I don't know, it's like, was it 30% of or 40% of the storylines?
Well, yeah, but there's also like 6 books, which are
massive. I know, and they're super.
Each of those books are even bigger than Dune too. So
to touch on the books too, and I mentioned this in the previous pod we did, but I think the first Dune book is amazing, and then I think the series just goes completely downhill after that. I know there are probably some people that are really diehard fans of Herbert and the whole series, but I don't know. I made it to the fourth book, and at that point, the son of Maudib was a giant sandworm and was making 5,000-year time jumps, and I'm like, fuck this. It was just like I couldn't take it anymore.
With respect to Game of Thrones, Duke Leto is a lot like Ned Stark.
Yeah, that's true.
He goes to Arrakis out of duty because the Emperor sends him, right? He knows that there's political danger. He uproots his whole family. He then gets betrayed, dies, and loses his entire family. That's the Ned Stark story arc right there. I think that George R. R. Martin probably had some definite inspiration from
Dune.
From Dune, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they all follow the same storyline.
Right? I mean, there's a lot, but yes.
Joseph Campbell's
when I started thinking about it, I was like, oh my God, that's like Ned Stark right there.
Yeah. It's very, very close, you're sure.
I do have some questions before we get to the cast.
Okay, go for it.
First question out of the gate is, what do you prefer, Harkonnen or Harkonnen?
It's funny you say that because I actually had a note here, which is I am going to use Harkonnen through this entire pod because Lynch got to it first. Harkonnen is forever buried in my brain at this point. I don't know what the actual pronunciation is. I don't know if somebody ever got Herbert to say it out loud, but Harkonnen is what I'm going with.
Okay.
I like Harkonnen also.
I do too, but then now as I've been watching, I feel in my brain it's starting to change.
Uh-oh.
Which version of the Harkonnens do you like best, 84 or 21?
You know, I'll go 21, but in general, I hate all the Harkonnen scenes from both these movies. Like, you know, I just would like to skip past them because the Harkonnens are just presented as these horribly gross, disgusting people. In the Lynch version, you have, I forget the actor who plays the Baron, but he's, you know, there's a scene where they're...
Kenneth MacMillan.
Boils on his face and the heart plug stuff we talked about earlier. And in this one, you have Stellan Skarsgård, who's just slowly emerging out of piles of oil and, you know, and just this huge fat covered in steam. There's, the Harkonnens are gross. I like neither of them, but I'll take the 2021 version because they are slightly less gross.
Less gross.
Yes.
What about you, Marcus?
Oh, I haven't seen the Lynch version yet. Stop pushing your Lynch weirdness on everyone.
The Harkonnens in the Lynch version, they're just amazing. They're like these BDSM weirdos with redheaded stepchildren. It's so weird. And you called it the anti-Mohawk, I think, in our last podcast. Or the reverse Mohawk.
The reverse Mohawk, yeah.
I totally forgot about this, but there's this kid in elementary school who showed up one day, it was probably in second grade, who had that same haircut. Apparently, he took out dad's razor and he cut a swath into his hair.
The no-hawk.
To teach him a lesson, his parents must have just like sent him to school. And then I'm hoping they gave him a real haircut after that.
That's funny.
Hey, kid, if you're out there and you're hearing this, send us some feedback. We want to know if you're doing okay.
Oh, my God. If I could get a picture of him, that would be amazing. I'm very fixated on the Harkonnens here, but
well, you just said that they were into BDSM weirdo stuff, right?
So that's true. Yeah.
I guess you're on brand.
Do you think that Villeneuve was influenced by Lynch's portrayal of the Harkonnens? See, I'm doing it.
You can't even figure it out for yourself.
You're lost now.
I read the book, and there really isn't really anything in there about their weirdness other than the Baron is 440 pounds, and he does ride around on suspensors. And yeah, the Harkonnens are brutal, but there's really nothing there in the book that goes into that, unless it's stuff from all of those sequels where they delve into that more.
Yeah, I don't see how Villeneuve could not have been influenced by the Lynch version. It makes me wonder about what's in the description of the book, because you guys have read it more recently than I have. The way that the ornithopter is circling after the worm attack in the desert, It's very, very similar when you look at the Lynch version. That's one thing that I had to manage when I was watching this, was some sort of ongoing comparison that would crop up a little bit along the way.
Yeah. Second question, or maybe fifth.
Second.
And this is something that book 84, 2021, it applies to all of them. Does anybody really buy Dr. Yui's betrayal?
No, I don't. And I think that Yui's betrayal, and actually Yui's ability to sabotage the shield generator, his abilities seem to be way overstated. And then also, in this movie, he says that they were taking his wife apart, or, you know, taking her apart like a doll or something like that. I forget what the line is. If you assume that that's happening, I mean, you have to assume that Yui has gone insane. There's no rational way he assumes that his wife is going to be alive or that he's going to be left alive. The casual nature with which Yui is dispatched, you know, a 2-second moment, Baron cuts his throat, it's over. It really undermines the whole betrayal. The other part of this is, why did the Atreides go in the first place? I know it's a trap. The Atreides in this movie know it's a trap. Whoever walked into the 12:30 showing in Lincoln, Nebraska at the multiplex knew it was a trap.
You know who else knew it was a trap? Admiral fucking Akbar.
Admiral, we have enemy ships in Sector 47. It's a trap.
Everybody knows it's a trap. So why did the Atreides so willingly walk into this? Because it doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, my thought was that they knew it was a trap, but they thought they could harness, and they talk about it too, they could harness the desert power. They'd be able to connect with the Fremen and be able to use them as the army to thwart the trap. We have a secret weapon with the Fremen, and want to make an alliance with them, and we'll be able to withstand this.
Okay, I mean, that makes sense. But I guess the question is really around the planetary defenses more than anything else, right? They do mention that satellites are not allowed at Arrakis.
All right, well, with respect to the satellites, turns out the Fremen are actually paying the Spacing Guild with spice to make the cost of purchasing satellites to put over Arrakis prohibitive cost. The Fremen do not want satellites spying on them.
Because they have a secret base that shows how large they are in the south, I don't know, east, west, some direction.
Yeah, the South Polar region.
They don't want anyone to know what they're trying to do, which is they're trying to turn Arrakis into, ecologically, turn it into a paradise. And so they're trying to change Arrakis, which means, ultimately, I think what
terraform
it means...
it, yeah.
It's the end of space travel, ultimately.
Yeah, and the spice is going to go away.
That's fine, but assume that you are the Atreides. Are you going to put yourself in a position where you're so vulnerable that the Harkonnens can bring in a huge fleet of planetary ships that are ready just to start crushing your base?
What they didn't account for, I think, was the Emperor betraying them also. So the Emperor gave them their
fighters.
I think that's what tipped the balance.
Leto knew it was a trap, right? But he sort of had to go because the Emperor was ordering him to go. And if he refused, they were going to have to go rogue as a house, right? I don't think he really knew of the Emperor's involvement in this. You said, how could they allow the Harkonnens to come in with such military might to crush them?
Right.
It all hinged on being betrayed. There was a traitor in their midst, and they knew that there was a traitor, but they didn't know who the traitor was. I think Leto figured that the Emperor would provide the Harkonnens with a few legions of Sardaukar, but not 10 legions. And then the other thing is that the Harkonnens were basically bankrupted. They had to spend so much money to put together that huge military force to take over Arrakis that it literally bankrupted them. And now, you know, he says to Raban, start squeezing. He says in the book that it's going to take them 60 years of high volume spice production just to make back what he spent on the military force to take back Arrakis.
So that's all very helpful. My question is more of a tactical one, which is, did the Atreides not maintain some sort of spacecraft to actually monitor whether or not, you know, a massive armada is actually above the planet?
How about a telescope?
Yeah, a telescope. Yeah. I think there are things about that you just can't answer those questions, because literally it's like the Spacing Guild, they're not transparent at all about who they're taking, what's going on up there. Should they have an early warning system? Maybe, but they had the house shields. And yeah, you're right. That seems a little convenient that Yui would be able to take down the house shields, and then essentially it's a sneak attack.
Right.
And so back to the original question, Yui knows his wife is probably dead.
But she wasn't.
She probably was.
No, she's being kept alive and being tortured.
He knew that she was either alive and being tortured, but really, are they really going to let her go? She's probably actually dead. They just keep saying that she's alive.
So what was Yui's motivation in the book, though?
That is it. So what is the motivation. Purpose? What is the purpose? The purpose is only to kill the Baron. So Yui is willing to sacrifice the entire House Atreides just to kill the Baron. I don't buy it. I just don't buy it.
Yeah, I think we can agree that it's probably the largest plot hole in both the film and the book. All right, what else you got before we hit cast?
What happened to Fade Rautha in the 2021 version?
More importantly, what happened to his oversized metallic codpiece?
he's not even a character. Is he coming in part two? What do you think?
It seems weird that they would introduce him then.
What kind of a role does Fade play in the first half of the book?
About the same as Sting does in the movie. He steps
out of a steam bath?
Yeah, he's one of the nephews. He's the heir apparent to the Baron.
But he's also whoever Paul was supposed to be a woman, a girl, and then Fade was supposed to marry her, and then their child was going to be the Kwisatz Haderach. It's an important character to just forget if you're going to pay attention to the mythology of it all.
Right, which is why I'm wondering, why is he not there? I think he's going to show up in part two. Why were some of these important supporting characters not really done much with in 2021? I'm referring to Yui and Thufir.
Because who gives a shit about Thufir?
But Thufir plays a big role in the book.
Even reading the book, do you give two shits about Thufir? I mean, honestly?
Well, I think he serves an important role. What you don't get is anything about really Mentats. Do they even mention the word Mentat? So you don't really know why Thufir, and also why Peiter De Vries.
His eyes just turn into his head.
Is he having a seizure? What's going on here?
I have
that
as a question, actually. I do. You know what it is, Colin? Here's what it is. I think that you're missing the oversized eyebrows from the Lynch version.
I am. No, absolutely.
You can only cover so much, right? So that's where he's cutting out some stuff, which is, I think, good. But you also need the 10-hour version is what you want.
How about three films instead of two?
Trilogy is always nice.
Another question. Why does Duncan Idaho get so much attention in this movie? Because he's a pretty minor character in the book.
Because he's played by Jason Momoa?
I think so.
He's basically there to add a couple of compelling action sequences.
Yeah. So I think he's sort of a fan favorite, maybe.
But I actually think that Jason Momoa does a great job as Duncan.
Oh, so do I.
You know, he has a little bit of his kind of Aquaman bro-ness that shows up a couple times.
His bro-ness.
Paul is his little brother, and that energy between the two of them, I think, is good chemistry. But then I also really like that there are a couple moments he bows down to Paul because he becomes the Duke, or the moment where he, you know, has the knife and he salutes him before when he knows he's going to his death. I actually think that he handles those moments really well. So I really like Jason Momoa in this movie.
Yeah, he did good.
Me too. I loved him. What I think may have happened was that they saw how good he was and the energy that he brings to this movie. And they're like, let's focus on that a bit because he's really good.
It's funny because you know, you're talking about how Villeneuve is a little bit too depressing for you, or if that was characterized. He actually is a bright spot in this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He lights up the screen a little bit in terms of positive energies. He brings a lot.
Sandworms, 1984 or 2021.
This one's interesting because I like the triangular version of the sandworms.
The mouth.
That you see on the, you know, on the actual Herbert book. So I do like the external design of the Lynch version. But I mean, everything that is Sandworm here in this film, I think is pretty amazing. So I'll go with the Villeneuve version.
Tremors.
Graboids!
Oh my God, Dune and Tremors. Just merge the two. It would be amazing. You get Val and Earl on Arrakis.
I love the line from our Halloween Kills pod where Colin says, does Michael Myers think that Haddonfield is one big smorgasbord? makes me laugh.
All right, I'm done with those questions.
Okay. All right, well, we've touched on a couple, but you want to just go through the cast real quick?
Let's do it.
How many have been nominated for Academy Awards?
How many?
There's four.
A few.
Three nominations and one win. Well, there's four total, so three of them nominated and one won. Timothée Chalamet for Call Me By Your Name, Josh Brolin for Milk, and then Charlotte Rampling for The Verdict. She was nominated.
Well, she took a punch really well.
Paul Newman just shows up and just clocks the Reverend Mother.
Boom. Oh, my God. You should do that. We should put it up on Twitter.
That's funny. And then Javier Bardem's the one Academy Award winner.
Oh, for No Country. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know where I'd give the Lynch version the advantage? The way that Everett McGill says, Mwadib.
You shall be known as Paul Mwadib.
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 We call that one Mwadib.
Could I be known as Paul Mwadib?
You are Paul Mwadib.
Mwadib.
Getting back to the cast.
Timothée Chalamet as Paul Atreides.
I think he's great in the role pretty much all the way through. My biggest question for him is, does he sell the very end of the movie? And I'm not quite sure that he does.
Sell in what way?
Just the transition to say, you know, my path leads into the desert. Out of everything in the movie and everything that he does, for whatever reason, that's the one part that maybe doesn't totally resonate with me, and I don't know why.
He doesn't seem big enough for you?
I don't know. It's the point where he's supposed to become the Fremen leader. I don't know. Just maybe.
But he's not at that point, though.
Right. He doesn't become the leader until he drinks from the water, right? Is that what sets him over the edge?
Part two, man. Stop with your spoilers. I think that's when he becomes the Kwisatz Haderach. The universe's super being.
I thought he was great. I thought Timothée Chalamet is great casting for it. I think he does a wonderful job. He's probably a little bit too old for the role.
No, I don't think so at all. I think he's perfect.
He doesn't look like he's 15.
No, in the ecological testing station, he looks like a teenager. He really does.
Well, and Kynes actually takes him down a notch at that point and says,
the Emperor feared the Atreides. He brought you here to kill you. What don't you understand? You're a lost boy hiding in a hole in the ground.
First of all, I think he does sell the ending. I think that he is great. His Paul is a little more emo than the 1984 Paul. It's like he doesn't have a lot of joy in his life. I think maybe he just has a crush on Duncan and he's sort of keeping it a secret.
I do think that because they do take the time where he's up on the bluff with his father, he basically talks about the burden of leadership and how he might not want to be the heir apparent to the Atreides line. He's living a depressed life because, yeah, he may not want this for himself ultimately.
Yeah. By the way, that's straight 2021 movie fiction. It's that's not in the book. He never says he doesn't want to become the Duke.
Laying that foundation for his character actions for the rest of the movie, I think it works.
Yeah. But I love Timothée Chalamet as an actor, and I think he's perfect for this role. My only quibble is, Paul, eat a fucking extra meal or two. Man.
He's a little thin.
A little thin. I will bend like a reed in the wind. You are a reed!
Okay, how about Rebecca Ferguson as Lady Jessica?
She's the star of the movie, I think. You don't agree?
I don't agree that she's the star of the movie. I'm a big fan of Rebecca Ferguson's, and I really liked the casting. I think it's a strong but very, I hate to say this word again, subtle performance.
I think the subtlety is what actually makes it such an effective performance. Her using the sign language to communicate with her guards or Paul, her ability to recognize the Fremen language. They give her character a ton of agency and power. The one place that's interesting is the relationship that she has with Paul as a mother-son. Not a lot of love or emotion that's being communicated in the back and forth there. At least I don't see it.
Yeah, I'd agree with that too. That's the one area where I don't see the connection as much. I think she does a great role with it. And
I mean, there's times where I'm like, do you have to whisper every line of dialogue?
You got your closed captioning on so you can read it.
Yeah, that's why.
I'm just getting old.
I have to, you know. But I am a big fan of Rebecca Ferguson's, and I do like her in this role. I don't think she's the star. I think there's somebody else in my mind who's the star of this film.
Jason Momoa?
From a casting perspective. Let's wait till we get to him.
I think the one problem I did have is, I think the age difference between her and Timothée Chalamet is only like 14 years or something like that, 13 years. They did seem a little too close then. They don't feel like a mother-son.
She's like 35, 40, and he's supposed to be 15.
Yeah, but in real life, he's 26, 27, or whatever it is.
Well, I think it works. He looks pretty young.
By the way, a quick plug for Rebecca Ferguson in Dr. Sleep as the leader of the bad guys. She's really great in that. And it's a surprisingly good movie. It's a sequel to The Shining.
Yeah, I liked it too.
I read the book. I haven't seen the movie yet.
I think the movie might actually be better than the book, honestly, on that one. I
have to check it out.
So we have Oscar Isaac as Duke Leto Atreides. I think Oscar Isaac is great in this role.
Again, very subtle performance. I'm not that crazy about Oscar Isaac.
Oh, really? Oh, I like him.
I sort of blame Star Wars because I don't really like his character in that.
Did you ever see Ex Machina?
Yeah, I was just about to say, I think he's fantastic in Ex Machina.
Yeah, he's amazing in that.
He's good. He's a strong performance. Again, strong but subtle.
He doesn't have much to do, truthfully.
Yeah, well, that's Leto, right? But he is rocking a fantastic beard. I mean, that is just an amazing, amazing beard.
Solid.
I only wish I could grow a beard like that. A little thing about Duke Leto here. There's this bullfighting theme. There's a painting of, I think, the grandfather in a sort of a matador outfit. There's the bull.
Grandpa fought bulls.
When he's laying paralyzed, he's looking up at the bull. Right. When the attack is starting, Paul is actually staring directly at the bull statues. Right. In the book, was his grandfather killed by a bull? Is that what it was?
Yeah, that is all lifted from the book. And I think I understand the significance. I think what it is knowingly putting yourself at great risk and yet doing it anyway. And what happened to Paul's grandfather? He died, and then Leto became the Duke. And what is Leto doing? He's putting himself and the family at great risk. And what happens? Leto dies.
That was my exact same read on it, because he actually references in the movie that your father, look what happened to your grandfather or whatever it was in terms of him dying from the ball. But that's kind of why I was asking about the Atreides in terms of their decision to go to Iraq, as if they know it's a trap, because I don't think Leto is necessarily making the choice. So I don't think it's a direct parallel to his father just having bullfights for fun, right? So I think he has no choice because the Emperor's forcing him that direction.
Yeah, he has no choice, but he also thinks that he can negotiate and get the Fremen as allies. He believes that the Fremen are even greater warriors than the Sardaukar. He wants to cultivate desert power, and that is directly from the book, you know, this idea of desert power. And so it's a very, very calculated risk. And unfortunately, the only thing really brings them down is the fact that there is a traitor.
So we're not talking necessarily about the performance. We're talking about the movie style. So.
Sorry. I know. I just got off on a tangent. But again, going back to Yui, I just don't buy it.
Baron Harkonnen, so Stellan Skarsgård, not a ton to do in this, but what he's given to do, I think he handles it really well. He makes Baron Harkonnen a disgusting human being, or whatever, Harkonnen, I guess.
Also, you know, father of Alexander Skarsgård.
Right. There's lots of Skarsgårds out there.
Well, not to be confused with Peter Sarsgaard. Sorry.
Do you want to talk Thufir?
No.
I think we covered it. Stephen McKinley Henderson doesn't get a lot to do with this character. Maybe they give him more in part two because Thufir still does play a role throughout the rest of the book. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, doesn't he try to kill Jessica?
He was going to, and then she gave him a what for. She's like, I'm a Bene Gesserit. I could kill you anytime. And he's like, oh, shit, you're right.
Gurney Halleck, played by Josh Brolin. Relatively straightforward, standard, tough, smart warrior guy. I think it's really good what he does with it, but I don't know that this is necessarily a requirement to stretch as an actor. Yeah.
No.
What's funny is the book has him a lot more
jovial, right?
Yeah, like he's like playing his instrument. Guitar and singing. It's not guitar, but whatever it is.
His guitar.
His keytar. He's rocking the keytar from the late 80s.
He's quoting the Orange Catholic Bible quite a bit. Yeah. I think Josh Brolin does at one point, and I think they do roll out the bagpipes, but I don't think he's the one who's playing them. And I think 20% of the characters in this movie, maybe in part two, he'll have a bigger role.
It'd be strange if he starts pulling out an instrument and starts singing then.
Yeah. Brolin's like, I don't have to sing for this, right?
It's probably in his contract. Stilgar, played by Javier Bardem. I think he's great. I think some of his mannerisms as Stilgar, they're fun to watch. I think he really inhabits the character.
He's my MVP.
He's like in it for 2 minutes.
He's the best casting decision, I think, in this movie.
I think it's almost overcast. Too many big names, and they're not given enough to do.
Yeah, I get that. It's like the cast of 1,000 stars, and you know, you get 2 speaking lines.
For how long is Stilgar on screen in this one?
Yeah, but again, he's part two. Some of these characters, I think, are going to have more to do.
Yeah. He's only in it 2 scenes. The Duke Leto talks to him.
Yeah.
And then the last scene with the fight, right?
Yeah.
How can he be your MVP then?
Because he just shines. He's so good as Stilgar.
So I actually like Sharon Duncan Brewster as Liet Kynes. I enjoy watching her. She definitely commands the screen.
Yeah, I thought she did well with it too.
I don't know Sharon Duncan Brewster. I looked up her IMDb. She's all right.
You're writing for Max von Sydow right now. Well, that's what's going on.
Yeah, I just feel like knowing this character, I think hers was the least interesting performance. It's really hard to top Max von Sydow. They're not trying to do that here. But even the character itself, they really cut down a lot from that character. Because she's supposed to be Liet, the leader of the Fremen. And they just cut that out completely. And so, you know,
you don't get that in the Lynch version, though, for Max von Sydow at all.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no.
As the leader of the Fremen? No way.
You don't. No. Not in the Lynch version. No. And there is such a great, great scene in the book in the ecological testing station. Paul is trying to bring Dr. Kynes over to his side to get his loyalty and have him on his side against the Emperor. And it is so well written. And they just could cut that out. They could have had it. I'm sorry, I just didn't like the performance.
I don't think that's performance, though. I think that's more the writing than what she's given.
I just felt it was flat. Look, I'm sorry, I just didn't like it. I think they handicapped her because of the writing of the character. And hers was the least supported or the worst written character.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah, maybe in relation to the book, but I thought her performance was actually pretty compelling. What's interesting, though, is so the Lynch version bypasses that entire sequence.
Yeah.
They never go to the atmospheric processing center or whatever it is, right? They just go right to the desert.
Well, the atmospheric processing center? Oh, shit. We're on LV-426.
Yeah, whatever you call that thing. So, Zendaya is in here as Chani.
Zendaya.
Doesn't have a lot to do. I do like her practicality as a Fremen, though. That's pretty fun. Hey, here's a knife. You can hold it when you die. So I like that part of it. That's fun.
I'm really looking forward to part two with her because I think she's going to be just knock it out of the park.
Yeah, I think she's great casting for Chani. In this one, she had almost nothing to do. And anyone who came to see the movie for her probably was disappointed.
Yeah. But I will say that the last, 15 minutes that she's on screen, she's really good.
Charlotte Rampling as the Reverend Mother. We've talked about this before. She has great eyes. So I think the eyes come through.
Can you see them, though? They're pretty much covered the whole time.
They're covered a little bit.
Those great dead eyes.
She just seems like she's really pissed off all the time. I don't know what it is about the Bene Gesserit, but they seem very unhappy.
She carries the knowledge of all Reverend Mothers before her. Of course she's going to be like pissed off.
She's like, oh, this is a lot of, I got too much knowledge. It's weighing me down.
I think her performance works. I think it's, again, very subdued. I loved the idea of Charlotte Rampling as the Reverend Mother. Absolutely.
Such a difficult storyline to tell, and I don't think they attempt it very well at all.
Yeah, that would be one of the questions I would ask my mom. Mom, who are the Bene Gesserit and what do they want?
Yeah.
It'd just be a slow head shake. I don't know.
I also think it's funny that Jessica just fucks up their 10,000-year plan.
You missed a couple people, but we'll circle back to them.
I think one of your favorite people, too. I don't know how you missed him.
Colin, would you like to talk about a person you want to talk about in the cast?
No. Well,
the Beast Raban. Don't you love Dave Bautista?
I do love Dave Bautista, but Raban is not really given anything to do here.
Casting Dave Bautista to it? Why bother?
He's perfect. He's perfect casting for the Beast Raban.
No, I mean...
Yeah, he looks exactly like he should look. If there's one person on this earth who looks like a Harkonnen, it's Dave Bautista.
I think he's not perfect casting just because he has such great comedic timing, and like his roles in Guardians of the Galaxy is fantastic. I think you could cast anyone in that spot. You don't need a big name there.
I agree with you on that point, that he looks the part.
Oh, for sure.
I think he was overacting a tad when the first time he comes in and he's basically yelling about killing that Duke. But he looks great.
By the way, Marcus, have you seen Stuber yet?
No, I haven't.
If you like Batista, Stuber is definitely worth a watch. Very entertaining.
It's very funny. And then we got Dr. Yui, who's played by Chang Chen.
Yes, what would you like to say about Chang Chen?
Do you have any comments?
No.
I do find the fact that he's a Vulcan interesting.
A Vulcan?
His medical treatment.
Oh, yeah. The mind meld.
Vulcan mind meld, right? It's the Vulcan health review, I guess.
Really my only comment on Chang Chen's performance. He is like an ASMR god.
Oh my gosh. I was going to say he's hypnotic.
Spice is a psychoactive chemical. Seem to be sensitive. You'll be fine.
I'm like, I'm almost going into a coma.
I suddenly got relaxed. And I was like, oh my God, I just want to listen to him all day long.
I want to find if Chang Chen's ever done an audiobook, I want to listen to it. I won't get very far, but it would be a fun listen. Good voice.
I'm going out right now and I'm hiring a Sook doctor. And then, of course, Peter DeVries, the mentat for Baron Harkonnen, played by David Destmalchian. You skipped over them because you wanted me to pronounce his last name.
No, he's a very small role.
Truthfully, I don't know that he is like a large enough character in this sea of characters. So that was the other reason.
And that's what I think is unfortunate, because he is a big character in the book, and they don't really give him much to do. By the way, do you recognize David Destmalchian? He was the polka dot guy from Suicide Squad.
I actually loved him in that role. He was great. So he crushed that.
He had more to work with there.
Yes. His visualization of the Suicide Squad as all different versions of his mother, that's a hilarious moment. So James Gunn, by the way, you crushed the Suicide Squad. So congratulations to you.
Okay, now we're going to go really quickly. I just want to go through who did it better.
How about this? How about this?
Come on. Who did it better?
Colin, no one gives a shit about the Lynch version as much as you do, honestly. So the only
okay, you could cut this out.
No. I mean, we can do this, but rather than going through the entire list, just how about this? Who do you think is better cast from the Lynch version versus this version?
All right, you walk me through the list, and I'll do it real quickly.
No, I mean, look at the goddamn list and give me the names.
Okay. Oh, you don't have the name.
I'm going to go get a drink of water.
Okay, we could do this without Marcus, apparently. Okay, this is a good one. Gurney Halleck, Josh Brolin versus Patrick Stewart. This is so easy. Patrick Stewart carries a puppy into battle, for Christ's sakes. How can you not choose him?
How about the shout out Meeps?
Oh, the shout out Mapes? Oh, yeah. You know who wins that one.
Linda Hunt, of course.
Fuck yeah.
By the way, I like the idea that she's the shout out Mapes.
the shout out Mapes?
let's give a shout out to Mapes.
Oh, shout out Mapes.
Do you have enough of the Lynch version out of your system at this point? Can we move on to the 2021 version?
No, it's all Dune 2021 from this point forward.
Thank God.
Okay, let's get to a plot summary.
Set in the far future, Dune follows Paul Atreides, a brilliant and gifted young man born into great destiny beyond his understanding, as his family, the noble House Atreides, is thrust into a war for the deadly and inhospitable desert planet Arrakis, home of the most precious resource in the universe, the spice melange. That's a long sentence.
It's very long. I didn't follow you.
And I think anybody who just is not familiar with the book and maybe has not seen the movie,
just
good
stop.
Luck following this podcast. Yeah,
just stop now. If you haven't stopped already, just stop now.
Jumping into it. So the film opens with a quote, "Dreams are messages from the deep," you know, showing the significance of Paul's dreams and visions. You hear the Sadakar language being spoken.
I do like the very bass sound of their language.
The sound of their communication, it always sounds a little bit like the very beginning of Radio Free Europe by REM. There's a high similarity there. So that's what I think.
I think it sounds like a vuvuzela or one of those aborigine
what do you call those things, like a mouth harp? What's not harmonica, but what's the like a dwang dwang dwang, whatever that thing is. I have no idea where this pod's gonna end up. It's fun now. Okay, so there is a brief moment of exposition where you have, I think it's Chani who is talking about what's happening in terms of the Harkonnens being there. You see the Fremen attack one of the spice harvesters. You know, again, my question is, if you're not familiar with this, is it enough exposition being familiar with it? I'm not really sure. Even the attack itself in the beginning, I think, is pretty well filmed. It's interesting.
It looks beautiful. The dust in the air and the filtered sunlight. And
it all is just, I mean, this movie is beautiful.
Yeah. You got the spice. It's like this coppery glinting in the dust. It really is beautiful, but thought it was sort of interesting that they chose Chani to narrate, because I was sort of hoping for a little Princess Irulan, but oh well.
Yeah, I did like the Princess Irulan voiceover from the 84, but I'll stop comparing.
Villeneuve is saying, this is a different movie. Don't think about 84, Colin. This is a different movie. And so I was like, okay.
Villeneuve probably should have put up one title card, actually, right after that first title card that just said was specifically for you. Colin, please do not think about the 1984 movie. Meanwhile, like millions of people across the planet are like, who's Colin? What's Colin? His obsession with the 84 version?
The Didgeridoo is the musical instrument there you go. You're thinking of.
Paul, so he's in bed. He's having a dream of Chani, and then he goes down to get some breakfast. Lady Jessica tells him to use the Bene Gesserit voice, which is the ability to influence people, kind of like the Jedi mind trick, only it's the vocal version of that. And he does use it to effectively get her to pass him a glass of water. I had one question here, which is, why does she get to train him in the way if it wasn't officially sponsored by the Bene Gesserit?
The weirding way?
Yes.
She wasn't supposed to.
Yeah, she wasn't supposed to, but
she did.
She's her son.
Wouldn't the Bene Gesserit end up just killing her off because she's blown the 10,000-year plan, though?
I think she's been sort of incommunicado for the last 15 years.
So she's been under the radar is what you're saying?
That's the only thing I can think. Although, this is a really interesting point from the book perspective. They knew that the Duke has a son. So why is it 15 years later that they're taking her to task for this?
Paul also learns that there's an Imperial emissary that's coming along to sign the documents on the transition, the handoff of Arrakis back to the Atreides. The idea that the Bene Gesserit would not know that she had a son until she arrives there, that doesn't really make any sense, because obviously, like you mentioned, his birth would have been announced to the universe, I assume. Wait, actually, can you clarify that? What does the book say? What's the sequencing there?
It's very similar. They don't explain it in there either.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. This is why the book is suspect as well. It's a plot hole. Like, why?
Do you also need that much pomp and circumstance to just like sign a piece of paper?
That's not in the book either, but I thought that was really interesting. And that's sort of like the only time you even get to see what I assume are the guild navigators.
Space guild. Yeah.
They're weird helmets.
They're helmets full of spice gas.
I do like that the helmets are all a little bit different. And there is one guy that appears to be wearing what looked like Xbox controllers on the side of his head. I don't know if you guys saw that. Like, that or it looks like a piece of exercise equipment from the late 80s.
By the way, another reason why I called Paul an emo character, because he sits down to the breakfast table and Jessica says, use the voice, you know, to pass the water. Oh, Mom, I just woke up. Come on.
I'm just having my lucky charms. Let me be.
Paul goes and meets briefly with Duncan Idaho. Duncan is apparently testing some aircraft. And mainly what this is, I think it's a mechanic to set up the relationship between Paul and Duncan more than anything else, that they have this relationship.
It is. That's all it is. The scenes on Caladan, it's very different than in the book. This would be the one section where it really doesn't follow the book that well. Paul is really much better friends with Gurney than he is with Duncan. So they sort of switch this.
They show the relationship, and Paul does it a couple of times. Oh, they're very close, because he goes up and gives him a big hug. He does the same thing with Thurford later.
He's the only one, his eyes light up when he's around Duncan. I think he's got a crush on him.
Well, he's the only one who's not just a big stick in the mug. Everyone else is just boring. Duncan's at least like...
I mean, pretty much.
The reason they give him to go to Duncan is because he says that he has had visions of seeing Duncan dead at Arrakis, and what he wants to do is he actually wants to go with Duncan. This, by the way, in his question to his dad later, hey, can I join the advance team to go to Arrakis? That seems like a real teenager moment. I mean, are you? Is anyone ever going to say, okay, yeah, fuck it. You just go to Arrakis. Have some fun.
Yeah.
As the teenager, as the heir to the Atreides line.
That is true. Yeah. It definitely seemed like a teenager moment.
This cuts to where he's up on the bluff with his dad. Paul is concerned about assuming the mantle of leadership. And his dad says, well, you know, I didn't really want to do it either. I wanted to be a pilot. I do like that moment because it plants a seed that pays off when the sandworm attack happens a little bit later in the movie.
I'm sorry. What are you referring to?
So when Leto actually, you know, folds the wings in on the ornithopter and goes into that dive, it's because he's realizing his moment of being able to be a pilot, like a true pilot.
Oh, okay. Leto. So, yeah, okay. Yeah.
So it's just one little line of dialogue that ends up paying off later in the movie, I think, at least in terms of Leto's character.
I just thought it was because Leto was a badass.
You see a moment where Paul is training with Gurney. This is also something that is paid off during the sandworm attack because Paul has his back to the door and Gurney steps through and he's pissed off. He says that that's dangerous. And Paul says, well, I can hear your steps, old man. Paul repeats that when he's having his vision moment.
Those footsteps could have been imitated. What do you think about the shields?
They suck. They're completely useless. Like, I don't understand the point of these shields at all.
Everybody has rockets that are blowing up these massive ships, but they're still fighting hand to hand. What's the deal behind that in terms of the book with the mythology?
The shields can only be penetrated when it's slow. So basically they're trying to remove bullets. Or like blasters. Go ahead, Colin.
You're right. So the shield, the slow blade penetrates the shield, right?
Right.
So yeah, if you have projectiles, the shields are going to help defend yourself, which is why everyone, they carry around swords, right? They actually fight hand to hand with swords in this movie, and they did in the book as well. Bullets don't work.
I'll challenge that though, because there are several instances of this where they basically fire, you know, what ends up being a slow moving dart that drills into the shield when it hits you, right? So sure, maybe you're not using regular projectile bullets, but why wouldn't you just be spraying those things all over the place? Because the it's darts? Just the same.
Well, I think you saw that Duncan
knocked it off,
grabbed it and was able to like throw it away right before it actually hit him.
If you had 17 of those things on you at the same time, I think you're going to die, right?
Okay. Yeah, I agree.
It's really mainly done because I think of the Chris knife and the significance of that and fighting hand to hand with the daggers in the desert and all that.
That's basically the reasoning. They just don't want any blasters and guns. They just want everyone to fight with knives.
They're not primitive screwheads like we are. They do actually have laser guns, but if a laser gun hits a shield, it will create
nuke.
An atomic explosion. So
yeah.
So that's why they're all carrying around swords, because everyone uses shields except the Fremen. And the only way to really effectively battle each other is to have swords. In the books, they actually used artillery against the shield wall, which trapped the Atreides into the caves. No.
They used artillery on us.
I was just saying, go ahead. I was just waiting to see who was going to drop
the... Someone do it.
Who's going to drop the Die Hard reference? Okay, thank you. Complete. Okay. You go briefly to Giedi Prime, and this is where you meet the Harkonnens and Stellan Skarsgård in steam, slowly rubbing his body, going...
It's Stellan Skarsgård doing his best Colonel Kurtz from Apocalypse Now.
It is totally Colonel Kurtz. That's a great call-out, actually. That's exactly what it is.
You're an errand boy sent by grocery clerks to collect a bill.
What the Baron basically says is that, oh no, it's a trap. You know, when is a gift not a gift? Because really, this is all a way to allow the Harkonnens to effectively destroy the Atreides, because that's ultimately what the Emperor's going for.
By the way, if you're trying to explain a densely complicated plot to your audience, why are you speaking in metaphors? Just come out and say it. Don't. Just, when is a gift not a gift? No wonder your mom's scratching her head, you know? Jesus Christ. Even Raban's like, when it's not your birthday.
What happens after this is you see there's another space navigator ship that shows up, and this time it's just one ship that departs, and it is the Reverend Mother who is showing up to confront Jessica about the fact that she's had a son. There is an interesting visual moment where the ship is descending and going through the trees. It's very reminiscent, by the way, of the E.T. ship.
Oh, yeah, it does sort of look like that, right?
It really does. There's a lot of similarity in terms of the lighting. Again, but it's kind of a cool, you know, beautiful shot. Lady Jessica goes to wake up Paul and basically says, you have to go talk to the Reverend Mother and do exactly what she says. You know, Jessica asks Paul to have Yui give him a, you know, kind of a quick once over. So you have Yui speaking Mandarin here. Is this our same universe, only it's 10,000 years in the future? Or is that really?
Yeah, that's what it's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I didn't know that, if Dune was its own separate universe or not. Paul goes in, he has to put his hand in the box. He doesn't have to put the lotion in the basket, but he has to put his hand in the box.
I was thinking the same thing.
It puts the hand in the box. Put your hand in the fucking box.
All begins going through the test, and I think this is one of the strongest moments for Timothée Chalamet.
I totally agree.
I love how, you know, he's experiencing it, and then he just gets up and he locks eyes with the Reverend Mother, and it's kind of like, fuck you in your pain box, right? Because he's using his training to get past it.
Fuck you in your shine box.
No, that would be good, fellas.
He sells the pain really, really well in the beginning. He starts, you know, reciting the litany of fear. And so he shows his control then over the pain. And it's a really good performance.
So the Reverend Mother and Lady Jessica, they walk out and they're having a conversation in the fog, apparently not realizing that Paul's like standing 10 feet behind him or whatever.
It's foggy.
The ultimate objective of the Bene Gesserit is crossbreeding to develop this kind of super being, if you will, that can see the future. The suspicion is that Paul could be it. My question to you guys is, if you walked in on your mom having that conversation with somebody else, how would you feel? Would you feel betrayed that you have a bad relationship with your mom? Or would you feel excited that you were perhaps the ultimate being?
I think we'd be pretty excited.
I think if I walked in, overheard this conversation, and I heard like Kwisatz Haderach, I'd be like, I'm Jewish? I didn't know. Yeah, I'm a little thrown off, like if you're hearing that for the first time.
I'm sure your mom probably told you you were special when you were younger, right?
Yeah. Very similar here, except that...
Except he might be a being of ultimate power, so where my mom just meant I was special, and she loved me.
Normally, it wouldn't have been a big deal. It'd be like, oh, you're so special, but here, she has to whisper the whole time. Then it's clear that this is really, really special.
Extra special.
It's extra special.
The Atreides, they're packing up, and they're getting ready to go to Arrakis, so you have a great packing montage.
We're going to have a montage.
You got to have a montage. There's lots of stuff in the room, and then there's less stuff in the room. So,
Villeneuve does do a great job with the montages, though. Beautiful scenes. You got like ships rising from the ocean.
Oh, the ships rising like, from the ocean is another, oh, just man. In terms of the scale. I mean, it's just beautiful.
Why cover character developments when you can have 3 minutes of ship rising out of the water?
I'm okay with it.
Why do you need to park your spaceships underwater?
Saving space.
Is there not enough land on Caladan?
Caladan's mostly water. The land part is highly desirable, so they do it for space.
Okay, I'll take that.
The land that is available on Caladan is mostly mountainous, too.
Where are the rest of the people on Caladan?
I don't know. Maybe they live underwater, too.
House Atreides, home of the Gungans. No wonder they're leaving for Arrakis.
Misa sad, Duke Leto dead. They then arrive on Arrakis.
Yeah, and it's like, bam, they're on Arrakis. One day you're on Caladan, and the next second you're on Arrakis.
Well, let me ask you this. Did you want the flying worm thing?
I did. Yeah. I mean, I was expecting something.
Do you think the folding space sequence from the Lynch version works well? Do you think so? Or do you think it's just like a weird, confusing mess of bizarre shit?
Does it work well? Yes, I do. It's bizarre and everything. I was just expecting like some sort of thing where you got spice navigators high on spice and folding space, but no, you don't get any of that. And then when I read the book again, I was like, oh, there's nothing of that in there either. I was expecting something. And there was really nothing at all. It was just like, boom, here's the guild ship. It's in orbit, and you get the little tiny Atreides ships coming out.
I thought it was effective enough.
And then you get a great shot, or kind of a cool shot, of them coming down through the atmosphere, too. The scope and the scale of the atmospheric landing and the size of the landing area. And, of course, you have them walking out with bagpipes, and it's all the pageantry and all that is actually pretty cool. I do have a couple questions here.
I knew you would.
Why is Paul not armored? Gurney has full armor. His dad has full armor. He's just in casual clothes. So what's the deal there? Because isn't that a risk for him?
I think maybe it's like ceremonial battle dress. It's not they're not actually dressed for battle. It's just ceremony.
I mean, they're surrounded by army.
You got Lady Jessica paying homage to Xerxes wearing her best face chains.
And then behind that, by the way, you have a fashion show that's going on because there are several women with long flowing gold robes that are walking the catwalk behind Leto. It's a weird collection of people coming off that ship.
It's a formal ceremony, I think. That's all it is. They just happen to be wearing their ceremonial battle armor. Yep. And Paul, he's too young. He's not a soldier, so He's not.
This is where you first see the ornithopters. I think the vehicle design on the ornithopters is pretty awesome.
They rock. Yeah. They totally rock.
As a practical, I'd say no. Like, yes, a dragonfly can make it work, but right. I'm not sure if we can actually manufacture that.
This is another one of the really beautiful shots, though, of them heading towards the city, because you have some of the screen itself is actually slightly blurred because you have them in front of each other with the wing effect going. One beautiful shot after another. It's pretty visually amazing.
I thought it was interesting that when they're in the ornithopters traveling towards the city, that Jessica mentions the Bene Gesserit have been on Arrakis planting superstition. That is straight out of the book. It's the Missionaria Protectiva, responsible for sowing the seeds of superstition in primitive cultures. So not just on Arrakis, but in a lot of different planets around the galaxy, right? So that the Bene Gesserit order could take advantage of them when those seeds grew into full-fledged legends. So that's why you've got this legend of Lisan al-Ghaib. The Bene Gesserit had primed Arrakis and the Fremen for a possible legend. And she's like, things are fitting together here. And how can I use this to my advantage?
And where the hell was I? There is a moment where Lady Jessica has an opportunity to review some potential servants. I don't know what it is about this scene, but I find it super compelling. The actress who plays the Shut Up Mapes just sells this moment of revelation. And
when you have lived with prophecy for so long, the moment of revelation is a shock. Lisan al-Ghaib, the mother and the son.
She ends up giving her a Chris knife. I don't know. I think that sequence is pretty amazing. I don't know what it is about it, but I think it's, I find it very compelling.
One thing, nitpicking wise, the Chris knife was unsheathed without spilling blood. That's a bad move. And then Jessica actually says, she refers to the worms as a maker. Like it's the tooth from a maker, and they don't know anything about.
Wait, who doesn't know that term?
Non-Fremen.
Yeah.
They don't. Right. But you assume that the Bene Gesserit.
No, but Jessica said it.
She's Bene Gesserit.
But she doesn't know about the sandworms and the secrets of the sandworms.
She speaks the Fremen language, dude. I mean, you assume that she's been educated.
Yeah. That Fremen language it's based off of an old ancient language. So that's why she knows it. It's not that she knows the Fremen. She just knows Chiboksa.
God bless you.
All right, we're diving in a little deep. I was curious that Villeneuve made that decision to use that word.
But you have Paul gaining some information by watching videos for Arrakis. And one of them covers the sandworms. One of them covers how the Fremen move across the desert with their sandwalk, which makes me wonder, it must take the Fremen 14 hours to walk 3 miles.
Yeah.
Can you see like all these guys like out like sliding on the sand, doing a dance, like just cruising along?
It's super, super awkward. I'm pretty sure that they showed it once in the video. They showed it once towards the end of the film when Jessica and Paul are traveling across the desert, but then they pretty much cease to show it after that. I think it's because it's like so goofy.
Right.
Nobody really wants to watch that.
It is pretty goofy looking. And one of the things that happens is that Paul, he goes out and he finds somebody who is managing a series of palm trees and giving them water. They were not indigenous to Arrakis, but they are noted as being sacred trees. Then the Harkonnens arrive and the Harkonnens attack. And one of the things that they do is they burn the trees. But they've been there for a couple hundred years or whatever, so why didn't they burn the trees before if they didn't want the trees? I mean, what's the significance of them burning it the second time they arrive? It's a nice visual of the trees burning. I get it. But it just didn't really track for me.
I think it's because the Harkonnens are just assholes.
Right. But you could have been an asshole earlier when you had the trees there the whole time.
This is during a battle, so.
So Paul sees a mouse, a small mouse in one of the videos. So he sees a little Maudib on the ground. And he is inexplicably drawn to it. He starts his relationship with the mouse at that point. Not a physical one.
He starts a relationship with a mouse.
It starts his association with Maudib, the mouse, yes.
Fievel, I found you.
And then a hunter-seeker enters the room.
It's going to assassinate him.
And so it goes zooming across the room at one point, and it stops right in front of his eye. Why did it stop? It doesn't seem like it should stop.
No, I don't.
You lost track. Who knows?
And you find out that a Harkonnen has been sealed up in the wall for 6 weeks. It made me think about that poor guy. Like, what's he doing for 6 weeks in the wall?
Dreaming about large women.
Treating his body like an amusement park.
Probably. How else are you going to spend the time? Cuts back to Giddy Prime again, and you see what is, I guess, what I would describe as a six-legged man ant eating a bowl of gruel.
No, it's like an eight-legged woman spider. It's pretty interesting, I thought.
Yeah, it's gross.
They try to really, you know, make the Harkonnen seem weird, trying to compete with Lynch's Harkonnen weirdness.
They have spider pets. No big deal.
They activate the cone of silence from Get Smart.
All right, right, right.
So they could talk in quiet. And this is where the Reverend Mother basically says that the Emperor is willing to support the Harkonnen assault on the Atreides by providing some Sadakar support, which are his specialized soldiers.
They're supposed to be the fiercest warriors in the universe. They're the Emperor's own, and they are trained on the prison planet of Seleucus Secundus.
Why are the Bene Gesserit brokering this deal? Like, why are they the messengers here for that?
Because they know that's going to happen anyways, and they want to secure Paul's safety.
Really?
Oh, okay.
Really?
Yeah, because that's a negotiation.
It's also sort of a plot device. She is the Emperor's truth-sayer, and so she's basically representing the Emperor here. And
she wants to spare Jessica and Paul.
Yeah.
And the Baron says, yeah, sure, sure. We won't kill him. We'll let the desert do that.
We'll just go drop him in the desert and see what happens. Duncan, with his advance mission, had been out scouting a relationship with the Fremen. He talks about the fact that a Fremen almost killed him, and Duncan's supposed to be, you know, one of the finest warriors in the Team Atreides.
Team Atreides.
This is where you meet Javier Bardem for the first time, and the energy with which he walks in is, Stilgar don't give a fuck. That's how I describe it. So so he has a knife that he's not willing to surrender. The guards ask him to stop. He just keeps walking. It's so much fun.
Just marches up there and spits right on the table.
I don't think they explain the importance of water quite enough in the 2021 movie. They don't cover like recovering the bodies and getting the water out of the bodies. And I know the book goes really deep into that.
I agree.
Because even the scene with the palm trees, I don't think they quite dive deep enough into the importance of water.
What Leto is basically promising is that he'll spend as little time in the desert as is required. He's trying to build an alliance with the Fremen.
I like this scene because there's Stilgar, but also like it sets up Duke Leto for his plan to make an alliance with the Fremen. It's just a really good scene between him and Jason Momoa. I don't think they had that same scene in the 84 version.
I do like that it has the idea that it's colliding two worlds as well, right? That I think is pretty interesting because you have Atreides and the whole Imperial House, and then you have the Fremen. The Fremen live with a fierce practicality. So then from here, it shifts to really what I think is the centerpiece of the film, going out and observing the spice harvesting in person. And of course, you get the worm attack. And she gives an overview that basically says, okay, you know, the still suit, it'll harvest your sweat. It'll, and recycle water. I have to ask this question. I'm assuming that you take a dump in your still suit. Is that correct?
Yes, urine and feces.
Right. So how does that work exactly? Like
you go behind a rock and you just stand there until you shit.
All of a sudden, my Stilgar says, I must go behind this rock for 7 minutes.
Hey, Stilgar, you look like you're in intense thought there. What's going on? He's like, shut up, I'm taking a shit.
The mechanics of how that would actually work, though.
I think people probably wait until they like they're sleeping, and then they pretend they're going to sleep, and then they're like, because you gotta think you're pretty dehydrated, you know, right. So you're gonna have these little rabbit pellets coming out.
Okay. The mechanics of still suit shitting are somewhat confusing. What did one of our friends who shall remain unnamed recently say? They put a thumper in the bathroom because they summoned Shia-Lud. Oh, boy.
Oh, man.
We're spiraling. That's what happens when you hit 2+ hours. This whole sequence is really genuinely amazing. And I think a lot of it has to do with how they filmed the sand and the sandworm and sand exploding upwards and the scene where the dune collapses. I just think it's visually amazing. I could watch that scene over and over again.
The way the sand trembles and vibrates, it's really, really cool. It's a worm sign. There's no crazy static electricity. You see this mound moving through the sand. It's like a shark moving near the surface of the water without breaking the surface. And then you see all the sand and dust in the air, and you see these coppery glints of the spice. Really, really, really well done.
The other thing I really like about this scene is, and I know it's not in the book because I don't think he exits the ornithopter, the visual cue when his foot first hits the sand of Arrakis, like that noise for a second, I think it's really well done. And then as Paul goes out and the spice hits him, he ends up having a vision right there as the, you know, while the sandworm's attacking. He decides to take a break, so he just kind of chills out for a minute, and then Gurney has to go run and grab him and pull him back onto the ornithopter.
Gurney, you're hushing my buzz!
He's having a good time out there. And then, of course, you see the sandworm come up from underneath. It's a really cool shot because you have Paul and you have Gurney, and they're out on the back of the open ornithopter as this huge sandworm is swallowing the harvester. All of it, I think, is just pretty amazing.
Great scene, but I have to question the logistics and the QA team on the extraction. Like, you got to test those things beforehand. A little upset if I was a harvester and the carryall hasn't been tested in a while. Come on.
All I can say is that anybody who works in that situation, nerves of steel. You know, it's like you're going to be out there and every single time a sandworm's going to come and attack you. That's a tough job.
Yeah.
You think you test the equipment a little bit. Why did they want to like not go on the things? They wanted to keep harvesting even when the carryall was like broken. They're just going to die. Like, why continue harvesting? You're not going to...
Where are you going to go?
Well, I don't know. Like, at least like chill. Well...
you would do. You just stick your face into a pile of melange and go to town. Just
like breathe it in. Like.
And then afterwards, so you get another moment with Dr. Yui. So that's nice because you get to hear his voice again. And like I said before, Spice is a psychoactive, whatever he says.
I just didn't even hear what he was saying because, yeah, I'm just like,
She asked Paul about, you know, what happened out there. And he basically says that he had a vision. He also mentions to his mom that he knows that she's pregnant. Which I had a question here, too.
Birds and bees, or you need like Lido and... okay.
Where does the penis go?
The pistol goes into the stamen.
We're starting to have these conversations with our daughter. Thankfully, she's asking my wife.
Doesn't Jessica have the ability to control her pregnancy?
I think she can control what kind of child she's going to have. Dictate which sperm goes where, which egg gets fertilized or whatever.
Wow.
I guess she could control.
That's what I was asking about the book. I thought she had some ability to do that.
Time for me to tell the truth here. I'm only 300 pages in.
I'm going to recommend to the disciplinary committee that you be expelled. You are a cover-up artist and you are a liar.
I actually don't know what happens in the rest of the book yet. For the events that cover this movie, there's nothing mentioned about her ability to control her pregnancy.
Yeah, she can control, because they were telling her to have you're supposed to have a girl.
Yeah, you're supposed to bear only daughters.
Well, they did, yeah, but they didn't go explicitly and say, like, you can pick which sperm you'll allow into the egg.
I don't think it covers it at all, but I think she has to have some sort of control to be able to determine which sex she's going to have.
Okay. She uses the voice on her uterus. Make it a boy child.
From here, this is where you're introduced to the Sadokar. So you go to Seleucia Secundus. Is that how you pronounce that?
That's it,
sure.
By the way, in my head, I think after reading that book, I always thought of it as Salsa Secundus. You have like the Pico de Gallo squad or whatever. It's like
the Pico de Gallo squad. Oh, my.
There's a very Harkonnen influence to this whole scene, and there's a very Lynch weirdness maybe influence to the scene, because it just cuts to... this guy, again, doing the Radio for Europe thing and you know, speaking from the tower. You have a bunch of guys hanging upside down that are bleeding into pools of water, and the blood's being used to mark the forehead of the soldiers. It's kind of disgusting and a little weird.
It reminded me a little bit of the Lord of the Rings, the creating of the orcs, said by Saruman. Like the marking, right? The white hand. The marking of them too.
I mean, look, these are a much better version of the Sadokar.
Oh, hell yes. This is a massive improvement over the Lynch version.
Yeah. In the book, they don't really describe them that well. So I'm glad they created this scene.
The one thing I think the book covers is like how elite and specialized they are.
Everyone's fucking afraid of them. That's what it is.
And that's what like it makes the Fremen even more impressive, is that they can defeat them. And they're the undefeatable.
The Fremen, they're sort of mocking the Sadokar. Yeah, they're all right fighters. And then Thufir is going, wait, you captured Sadokar?
Yeah.
What? Like, that's inconceivable.
Yeah, and then so from here, this is where the attack starts. Again, it started by Dr. Yui just somehow casually strolling in and shutting down the shield barrier. Not sure exactly how he pulls that off as a doctor. I'm a doctor here. I need to go in and look at the shield generator.
And no one notices. And
like, yeah. Well, apparently he must just be giving everyone some sedatives. He's like, oh, did you just get a haircut? Right into the neck. Hey, your brother, your pal over here, he's sort of nodding off. Psst.
Yui's betrayal, you know, some of it works, some of it doesn't. He does end up paralyzing Leto, and then he gives him this poison tooth. This is all about just trying to kill the Baron. And Paul and Jessica end up being captured, and you see Duncan's escape. There is a fun moment where he killed a few Harkonnen, and he's running out towards an ornithopter, and he kind of dares a couple of the Harkonnen guys to fight him.
Yeah, it's funny.
No, it's good. You can go. That was a fun moment. And then, you know, there is a moment where he's flying away, and they're using this big overhead laser to try to, you know, follow him, and it's blowing up the city. That was the one part where it felt a little bit like a brief, small Roland Emmerich moment that was tucked into a Denis Villeneuve movie. Does that happen in the book? Does he go through that? Do they chase him with a big laser?
I don't think so, but they do talk a lot about... Well, actually, did they do that in this one where he... No, they didn't. Never mind.
You just went on a journey there.
Sorry.
Did you have a spice vision?
In my mind, sometimes I have trouble differentiating like what happened in what movie or the book. Or it's really hard.
I think they use the lasers on the shield to like blow the generators.
They used the lasers against the shield generators and it created a huge atomic explosion. Duncan, he had done that when he was like getting away. They had all sort of left and boom. By the way, the whole attack sequence by the Harkonnens at night, really, really well done. Amazing orange flame from explosions. Also sort of simulating the daytime look of Arrakis, which with his shades of orange. It's really quite beautiful. This attack is about 1,000 times better than the one in the 1984 movie, which was really, really bad with hazmat suits and trampolines.
I'm not sure Lynch is a good combat photographer.
So all of the hand-to-hand combat scenes are done really well, especially with Jason Momoa.
I was imagining Lynch landing at the beach in Normandy, and like he's got his camera out there. Sorry, continue on.
So Paul uses the voice. They get the gag off of Lady Jessica, and then she just takes a knife and just casually sticks it right through the Harkonnen, and then gets up and then just does the coup de grace on the guy that's on the ground and cuts his throat very casually. Immediately pivots to Paul and says, "Your pitch was off," right? So she just kills two guys, and then she gives him some casual feedback on his usage of the voice, the Lady Jessica role. It's like she's a badass.
I guess that's the thing, is she in this movie, she's a bit more of a badass, whereas Francesca Annis, she was more dramatic.
Regal,
yeah.
Paul and Jessica are out in the desert. This is where you have the aftermath of the attack. The Baron shows up, and he's sitting there eating on the other end of a long table where you have Leto, who is naked and propped up in a chair with his head, you know, rolling back and looking at the bowl. The Harkonnens again. It's just gross.
I think this particular scene up until Leto's death, it is very similar to what they did in the book. And I really liked it. I don't think Leto was naked, but the rest of it was very on par with the book.
Leto has the tooth. You know, he cracks it and he blows it out, trying to poison the Baron. One thing I do like about this is the effectiveness of the poison. Like, it must be super powerful poison because it basically just destroys the room almost instantly. I guess the Baron, because he had his shield on, somehow he's protected from the poison. He's floating up near the ceiling at the end.
Everyone in the room died. That's
pretty brutal. Yeah.
Paul and Jessica, they're out in a tent in the desert.
It's a still tent.
Yep.
And there's spice in the tent, so Paul starts tripping balls a little bit, right? And he has this vision of 50 billion people being killed in his name. And so, I mean, I would say this is a bad trip. Like, I don't think he's having a good time. But one of the things he sees is he sees himself, I guess, reclaiming Caladan.
No.
That's Arrakis.
That's what I thought at first, too. But no, he's seeing the future. And what he's seeing is a transformed Arrakis.
Oh, interesting. So I misunderstood that because I...
Me too. At first I did too.
I thought it was his Fremen armies had retaken Caladan.
And this is why I think the movie can be pretty confusing, because I thought the same thing. And then when I read this part in the book, he was seeing the future of the Holy War spreading across the universe, like unquenchable fire. And he sees himself on Arrakis transformed with seas, you know, oceans. It's like, oh, that was actually Arrakis, not Caladan.
Okay.
Pretty confusing. I mean, that's the thing. I wonder, you know, some of the dream sequences, he's seeing the future or one of many futures. That's what he sees in these waking dreams. in the 84 version, you know this is like a dream or a vision. And sometimes in the 2021 version, you're not quite sure what it is that he's seeing.
Actually, so maybe then a quick question. So what happens to Caladan, you know, in the book?
I don't know.
Nothing.
They left it?
I honestly had that as a question. Is there an entire planet that the Harkonnens go and conquer or something?
I honestly don't know. I wonder the same things. Like, if you're packing up your royal house and moving to Arrakis, then is there a steward on Caladan who's going to rule in your stead? I don't know. They never really talk about it.
Somebody out there, send us a message at feedback@realdmc.com. Let us know what happened to Caladan.
In the 9th book of the series, if you made it that far.
Maybe.
Says the man who watched 13 Halloween sequels and can recite what happened in detail.
Paul and Jessica go out of the tent, and this is where Paul again sees Muad'Dib again for a second, little mouse. And you see the mouse has specialized ears to extract moisture from the air, and he's a survivor, that small mouse. Duncan basically is feeling a sense of failure, I think, for failing to protect the Atreides, and so he has an emotional moment where he grabs Paul's hand and holds it to his head. I thought that was a nice, smaller moment for Jason Momoa.
Yeah, Momoa, he's really good in this.
He had Leto's ring.
Oh, the signet ring, yeah, because Yui had given him that in the pack. Yep.
Yeah, it's just a cool moment because before it was Gaui treating Paul like his little brother, and all of a sudden, boom, he's the Duke. You have my loyalty, you know, sire.
Yeah.
I'm kneeling in front of you, you know.
When they get to the ecological station, they mention that they're going to have some coffee service. I do like that coffee service is partially prepared by everybody donating some saliva.
That's the way it is in the desert, man.
There is a fun moment here where you see the Fremen and they're getting ready for this coffee service, and then they detect the Sadokar, and then the next thing you see, all the Fremen have disappeared. It speaks to their ability as these desert warriors and their ability to get under the sand.
They're like ninjas.
They're like sand ninjas.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that particular scene with the Sadokar because you see it's like up very high, and then you just see them silently floating down.
Yeah, it's cool.
Really pretty cool.
Duncan ends up sacrificing himself in another, I think, a really good moment.
Mm-hmm.
Jason Momoa gets to sign off using some sort of ceremonial gesture, but he knows he's going to his death.
Yeah, yeah. So. He's sacrificing himself to save them. And it's a really powerful moment. And he's a badass.
He takes down 8 or 10 Sadokar before they finally get him. It's fun. Jessica and Paul jump on the ornithopter. They fly into the storm. This whole sequence, I think, is pretty interesting. It's fine that it's an action sequence because there's a couple ornithopters that are chasing him and they fire missiles. Once they get into the storm and the storm starts knocking around the ornithopter, basically his decision is just to fold the wings in and let the winds carry them where they may be going. And I believe this is an extended analogy to his fate as becoming the Messiah, the winds of change spreading across the universe. That was my read on that moment.
Sure.
I can see you guys are totally bought in.
No, I think he's just like, he couldn't fight it.
And he can't fight his destiny either, right?
Yeah. So just let the winds take him where they will.
What they did not talk about in this, and look, there's a lot of stuff that they cut out from the book. I understand it. Some of that, though, with Dr. Kynes and in the ecological testing station, I just feel they should have really kept that stuff in there. They're losing a lot. And so for me, that scene does not work very well. They're saying these things, they're sort of paying lip service to it, but it has no real resonance in terms of the plot.
Because in the book, they cover the transformation. Maybe they'll cover it in the second movie and they'll just do it a little bit out of order. The stations are these are the key to the planet and how they're going to terraform it into paradise.
Paul says one thing to Dr. Kynes. He mentions marrying the emperor's daughter. But what he's saying is that as emperor, he can deliver Kynes' dream of changing Arrakis into a paradise.
Yeah.
He saw this in his waking dream. What you thought was Caladan was actually Arrakis.
Is a princess even, besides that, is she even mentioned?
No. Yeah. But it's literally like one line. I just wonder, like, how much significance does that carry?
Yeah.
They just pay lip service and that's it. So I think it was a miss.
Well, so what do you think about the change with Kynes' death?
She dies well. I liked the scene where she dies in taking a few Harkonnens or Sadokar with her with the sandworm. In the book, I mean,
I thought she was just dumped in the desert.
She's
in the book.
Dumped in the desert. Well, his steel suit is all ripped off. He's having this conversation in his mind with his father, and he's basically going through the whole ecological part of Arrakis. And so that I understand if you're going to cut that out. Kynes is the adopted leader of the Fremen. He's playing two roles, and one's a secret identity, And they just completely cut that out of this movie. And I'll say enough about that.
There is another great visual moment here, I think, which is it's the first time that they're both in the full still suit and they have the headscarf part of it on top of it. And you see them setting off into the desert. I just think that that's a really great visual moment. Paul is becoming a little bit more one with his Fremenness.
Yeah. And I really did like the fact that they brought back the mouth coverings and the head coverings as part of the still suit.
Those still suits look great.
Yeah, they're really, really well designed.
The costumes are super effective. They're attacked by a worm, or a worm basically chases them. Of course, they're just full on running because nobody's going to be sandwalking their way in front of a sandworm at that point. But when they get to the rock and the worm rises up in front of them, I think it's a really cool moment. I am surprised that at that moment that you'd have Paul and he's yelling, "Somebody set off a thumper." Don't you think if you know this thing's triggered by sound, I'd be quiet as a church maudib at that point, just kind of sitting there like being just, you know, waiting.
Church maudib.
I see what you did there.
No, but I'm serious. Maybe it's just so big at that point that voice is irrelevant.
This was literally just to show the special effects with a huge sandworm.
From an effect standpoint, I think it's fantastic. The visual of when the worm goes back into the sand and it washes and splashes up as if it's almost water.
Like a waves, yeah, waves of sand, yeah, that's cool. Yeah.
I don't even know how they did all that, but I think their ability to manipulate sand is incredibly impressive in this movie.
I believe CGI would probably be.
Well, okay, yeah. So their ability to design the CGI. I think they did a fantastic job with it. In fact, I think a lot of the special effects in this film are just flat out amazing.
Oh, they're fantastic.
Yeah, really impressive.
I can't find any flaws in the effects.
Yeah.
We head towards the end.
By end, you mean the middle of the story?
Yeah. Well, halfway through.
Yeah. Page 283.
Of 600.
I do like the exchange between Jamis and Stilgar, because Jamis just wants to basically just kill him and take their water. Stilgar's like, yeah, okay, I guess we can train the guy, but or the kid, but yeah, she's too old. We're just going to go kill her. And then she ends up overpowering Stilgar.
Why didn't you say you were a weirding woman and a fighter?
Our conversation ran short.
Peace, woman. Peace. I judged too hastily.
I love his peace, woman. Peace. Yeah. I judged too harshly.
This is what I'm talking about. Javier Bardem is fantastic.
Oh my God. He's just crushing this role. I can't wait for more Stilgar in the second. That whole exchange is pretty great.
He does not say that Jessica ultimately, like after she overpowers him so quickly and he recognizes her weirding way. He doesn't say that she is worth 10 times her weight in water. That's a good line, and they didn't say that here.
Is that a line from the book?
Yeah. And also the 84 movie. And I don't think he said that they would take her with them so that she could teach them the weirding way.
No. It ends with Paul basically saying his path goes into the desert.
Yeah. I'm just assuming part two, they will talk about that. That was ultimately why they decided to keep her. Not just because she was a fierce warrior, but, you know, they could use her.
She can train her.
Yeah.
Stilgar makes a decision to give them both their protection. Jamis isn't having any of it.
What about Jamis?
Is it Jamis? Sorry.
I don't know. Like, is it Jamis or Jamis?
I don't know. So Jamis.
I want Jamis. Like Jamis Winston.
I think Jamis. Famous Jamis.
Jamis Winston threw 30 touchdowns and 30 interceptions.
30 interceptions? Yeah.
30-30 club.
So Paul has a vision of Jamis, and they seem like they're like best buds, and Jamis is teaching him the ways of the desert. But that's not what happens. So this is like he keeps seeing these possible futures.
My read on that at the time was you're supposed to assume that you can have multiple futures.
You can. Yeah, yeah. And that's
not all the visions are true.
Right.
Right.
Which is important for
the holy war.
Yeah, exactly.
The jihad.
They're not true, but they're possible. So what we decide to call him? Jamis?
Jamis.
So Jamis is going to get in a fight. He asks for a challenger. That ends up being Paul, obviously. And then Chani gives him a Chris knife. And I just the dialogue that she has there.
This Chris knife was given to me by my great aunt. It's made from a tooth of Shai-Halud, the great sandworm. This will be a great honor for you to die holding it. Jamis is a good fighter.
He won't let you suffer. Yeah, that's a great one.
You're just going to be practice for this guy. Like, that's basically kind of what she's saying. It's like, oh, here's a knife. Go die shortly.
Which does say a lot about what the Fremen feel about offworlders and their ability.
They're sources of water.
Yeah. You're all, like, really weak, and we can take you easily. And that's what they do with the Sardaukar, you know. They're all right, but We got him.
I think there was a mistake at that point, too, because she calls him Mod Deeb.
Nope,
at that
she
point.
Didn't. No.
She didn't?
No.
She called him the Mahdi.
Mahdi. Mahdi. It's like Messiah.
Chump.
It's like alternative to Lisan Av Gaib.
He has so many names, man.
Yeah, that they named the worms different things. I mean, it makes sense in the book, and it's a little bit easier to follow.
It is easier to follow in the book.
And maybe it's more realistic, but it's very confusing in the movie.
Well, when you mention it once in the movie, and you're like, what did they say?
Yeah.
Also, great reason to put the captions on.
But also, like, they call him something else when he first lands. They call him something else, like, for the Bene Gesserit calls him one thing, and then someone else calls him something else, and then you're the Messiah. Okay, I know the word Messiah. I know what they're talking about. And like, I understand the storyline, but they even do it for the sandworms themselves. And it just makes the movie very, very difficult to follow.
Shai Harun. Sorry, I love Everett McGill.
They end up having the knife fight. Paul is... He's not clear on the rules, so nobody tells the rules of the knife fight before it starts, by the way. So
he brought a gun to the knife fight?
Yeah, you know, he tries to get, what do we call him again? Sorry, Jameis. Jameis. Tries to get Jameis to yield. He doesn't understand that it's to the death. Paul doesn't initially want to kill him, so, you know, Stilgar says, is he toying with him? Because Paul is able to get what would be a killing blow multiple times and chooses not to take it. And then there's a moment where, you know, the music swells and he's becoming what is he at that point? He's just the leader of the Fremen, quits off Haderach, whatever visions. There's a bunch of shit that's kind of folding in on him at the same time, I guess.
Honestly, I did not like the sort of like whispers in the winds of,
he is like, Kwisatz Haderach, like, the must die too.
So I guess it's that moment tied with the speech that he gives just right after that. Like, those two things I think are maybe the only things that I'm like, well, maybe not 100%. I mean, it's still fine. I like it enough, but don't know.
I just don't think that him beating and killing Jameis in the duel, it necessarily is like this pivotal moment for him becoming the Kwisatz Haderach. Because it's not.
No, it's about him gaining respect of the Fremen.
Yes.
Is really what it is.
Yeah.
So I had a question. Jameis, is he trying to test the myth?
No, I don't think he's trying to test it. I think he just doesn't believe that at all. They're just off-worlders. He doesn't believe that Paul is the Kwisatz Haderach. And
by the way, I really do like the moment where Paul grabs his hand and he sits there and holds his hand as he's dying. So I think that that's really well done.
I don't know the name of the actor, but I really like him a lot, the guy who plays Jameis. It's really too bad that he got killed because I really wanted to see more of him.
Yeah, I love his voice, actually.
Yeah.
He has a great voice.
Yes.
I will not have them. You talk like a leader. But the strongest leads. She bested you. I invoke the Untal.
The night is fading.
Then the sun will witness this death. Where is our champion?
Babs Alusimokum, I believe is his name, and I'm probably butchering the pronunciation, but very limited screen time, but definitely very compelling. And I think he's great.
Yeah, I definitely want to see more of him.
I don't think I need to see more from Jameis, though.
No.
No, unfortunately, we're not. By the way, when Stilgar asks Jessica if Paul is toying with Jameis because he's not killing him, like, immediately, when he obviously is the better fighter and has the upper hand. So in the book, it's not that he hasn't killed a man before, like, then, because that's what Jessica says to Stilgar in the movie.
Didn't they just kill a bunch of people before that too? Like, in the escape?
I mean, I don't think he had actually killed anyone, but in the book, it's because he's so used to fighting with shields that he's used to the slow blade penetrating the shield. And so even though he gets the upper hand on Jameis, his thrust is sort of out of sync because he's trying to do it slowly. So he keeps missing. And that's why Stilgar's like, is he toying with him? No, he needs to adjust to not fighting with
shields. Yeah.
To fighting without shields. Kind of interesting. It wouldn't have worked in the movie. So I agree with this change.
I thought they just killed people. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was just Duncan and the escape and stuff.
It was just Duncan. I don't think Paul has actually killed anyone. What he should be killing is a few burritos. You know what I'm talking about?
You're finding him a little bit undersized for your taste?
It's not for my taste.
Your specific taste?
He's like maybe 98 pounds wet.
He's Mahdi. He can do what he wants. At the end, Paul makes the declaration that effectively he's going native. He's going to go with the Fremen, and his path leads into the desert. Again, just for whatever reason, for me personally, like this is the one scene in the movie that I'm like, well, I'm not sure I'm 100% there on it.
I think as an ending to the first part of the movie, it's probably a bit anticlimactic.
That was the response. Wait, what?
but again, for book readers, it's like you sort of knew. I mean, I pretty much figured even before the movie came out, probably going to end right around here.
One of the indications that I had that this was not going to be the full story was when the title said Dune Part 1.
I was going to say, the nice thing from Danelle was she was saying that it did feel quick. She's like, oh, that was 2.5 hours already. So it didn't feel like it was dragging on.
A lot of shit happens quickly in this movie. When you're 20 or 25 minutes into it, big pieces have been moved in relation to, you know, things that are happening and setting up the story and all that. So it's you could easily have made this movie or stretched it out into 3, probably.
Yeah. And then the best part of the ending is that you get to see a Fremen riding a sandworm.
Desert power.
That was pretty cool because that's very different from 84. There were no electric guitars playing.
I'm super curious to see how the sandworm trial is going to go. And also just the practicality of, can you really get on a sandworm? Like, is that really possible as a Fremen? I mean, I'm sure you put the thumper down and you have training, but it just seems like...
You got a couple of hooks.
It seems like getting across the sand when the sand is moving the way that it is would be difficult. So be curious to see how they film it.
Me too. I'm curious, are people just going to completely be confused during part two with the water of life and...
Oh, geez.
Like, oh, yeah.
I think, yeah, lots of heads being scratched on the way out of the theater.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how well part two does compared to part one also. I think the first movie here had a lot of build up and a lot of people excited. Like, I don't think Danelle's all that excited for part two.
For me personally, the sequel to this movie that's my number one most anticipated movie going forward at this point.
Yeah, me too.
And I'm surprised to say that, but I just thought this movie was pretty amazing. Honestly, I was very impressed with it.
I can't wait for the next, you know, Marvel movie that comes out.
As I say, I'll put that whoever the next James Bond is, I'll be curious to see that one.
What did you learn from this movie?
Oh, shit. I learned that Denis Villeneuve can really make a visual masterpiece. I'm not sure about telling his story, but visually he can capture some amazing scenes.
Colin?
I learned that the obesity crisis was solved in the future by suspensors. I learned that you can film a faithful adaptation to Frank Herbert's Dune, and it can be quite good, but it still may not make a lot of sense if you have not read the book.
I guess what I learned is that if you are on the inside, in the know, on the deep mythology, you can watch a movie like this and be greatly affected by it or impressed with it at least. And I think it's super ballsy, this movie. I'm surprised this movie in its current form actually got greenlit, I guess, is almost what it feels like to me. Like, to Marx's point earlier, I would think that maybe somebody would force you to try and make it more mainstream and more...
Dumb it down.
Accessible, I guess.
Simplify it.
But I'm so glad that he didn't do that, and I love this movie.
I mean, he did say, I will not agree to do this unless I can do it in 2 movies, knowing that there's a lot of story. Like, if you make it more accessible, then you're just going to be cutting out a lot of stuff and then it won't be good.
And Warner Brothers said, we'll pay you for one and we'll see how you do.
Like Duke Leader, they took a risk and they did not die. They might die in the next movie, but so far this one's been successful. It's profitable, right?
I think they made enough.
I mean, I'd be super curious to know how they factor in the HBO Max part of this too into the calculation. One thing that Villeneuve did bargain for in terms of the sequel is that it's only going to be a theatrical release. No simultaneous streaming platform release.
That makes sense.
Which is good. I mean, great. Let's see what this thing can do in the theaters financially when it's just in the theaters. I'd be curious. I'd be super curious to know what the box office would have been had this not been released on HBO Max.
My guess is part two, I think, will be less than part
one. I bet part two is more.
You also had the theater release. I mean, that's where it's hard to compare, I guess.
We've kind of wrapped along the way, probably, in terms of providing our opinions. But Marcus, your closing thoughts.
It's a visually stunning movie. Quite enjoyable if you know the storyline, quite confusing if you don't. I recommend spending a good couple of weeks, read the book first, and then go see the movie, and you'll enjoy it.
Colin, your thoughts on the 2021 version of Dune?
I think it was a very well-done adaptation of the book. I think it's a worthy successor to Lynch's 1984 disaster, which I freaking love, if we haven't already established that. I think it's a really great vehicle to deliver Denis Villeneuve's ability to show scale and beauty on the screen. Sort of fits in perfectly with that. It looks absolutely fantastic. Amazing cinematography. Lots of good actors giving good performances, although they're very subdued. And I wanted a little more energy. And ultimately, I think I kind of agree with you on Paul's character arc, but not necessarily at the end, but maybe towards the beginning on just sort of selling how special he is before they start talking about the Kwisatz Haderach. I mean, they don't even mention the fact that they were training him to be a Mentat from birth and he didn't even know it. This is like a really special, smart kid, regardless of this talk about him possibly being the Kwisatz Haderach. I really liked it a lot.
Yeah, I don't have much more to add other than I'll just replicate the praise for the visuals. This movie is just a visual feast. The scale and even the Arrakis, the desert imagery. I mean, I love the desert. That's where, you know, when I go hiking, I always tend to go to desert locales. So I just think that there's tons of beauty here.
Forgot to mention this earlier, but the scenes of the desert, whether it be the dunes or the rock, is absolutely beautiful. I think they maybe filmed it in, maybe partly in Jordan. Wow. Like, I'm not really a desert guy like you, but it is just stunning.
Yes, I think it's beautiful. And I think this movie is extremely well cast. I think all the actors do what is required of them and then, you know, beyond. I mean, I think it's, for the most part, compelling performances. I agree. It's subdued. It's quiet. But I'm ultimately okay with that. I was just kind of ultimately blown away by this movie, surprisingly so. I was not expecting to like this movie as much as I did. And I was just incredibly impressed with the artistry. This thing is just, there's artistry head to toe. Like I've said repeatedly, just kind of blown away by it. Really looking forward to part two.
Maybe in part two, Gurney Halleck will actually carry a puppy into battle.
And maybe the heart plugs will finally show up for the Harkonnens.
There's always hope.
I'll offer this as a closing thought, which is I think that this actually makes the Lynch version better. I think the existence of this movie, if you can kind of look back and retroactively go say, okay, well, what was Lynch forced to try to deal with at the time? I think he made a good movie, and I know it was very difficult. You know, obviously, when you have something that has a higher budget and is divided into two films, it's not a fair comparison, especially with the years between the two of them. But I think this made the Lynch version better, honestly.
The special effects and stuff, what would he make now? It's hard to say.
I don't think Lynch was the right director for the material. I think that's the problem.
He's just so weird. Like, he just embraces the weird.
You guys, and just don't. Not, I love it.
I just don't like Lynch. I agree with you, Colin. I just don't like Lynch.
No, I know. I know.
I don't dislike him. I don't think he makes bad movies. It's just not movies that I enjoy.
Anything else you guys would like to say about the 2021 version of Dune? And Colin, again, that is the 2021 version of Dune.
Oh, then no.
Okay. Marcus?
No.
Well, then, hope everybody enjoyed our long
and... How about letter grades? Would you recommend it? Come on, man. Oh. Follow your own damn outline.
Yes. So, okay. Letter grades, I will give this movie an A+.
Wow.
My first A+ that I've given, I think.
Oh, didn't you give Natural Born Killers an A+?
No? That was probably like an F-.
It was a D+.
I will give it a A-. I think it's visually amazing, but I think story it misses. If I didn't know the Dune background, it's hard to give it that high of a grade.
Oh, no. I completely agree with that point. I mean, I'm doing that as somebody who is informed and aware of the source material.
Yeah, so that's where I think it's really hard. Like, do you compare it as a standalone movie without, like, the rest of the universe and all that? It's tough to give it that high of a grade. Visually amazing, kind of hard on story.
Colin, great.
They should make you read a little book before you go into the theater.
You have to take a test.
I'm giving it an A-. And the minus is only there because some of the story, I really wish they would have kept, and it would have helped with some of the characters. Yeah. I think from an expectation standpoint, it totally delivered.
All right. Well, I hope everybody enjoyed our long and rambling conversation. I would say 70% of it was about the 2021 version of Dune. Colin was able to get at least 30% of conversation on the Lynch version of Dune.
Yes.
Colin is writing hard for the 1984 Lynch version, and will never stop doing so.
No, if you could just like meld the two together, oh my God, what an amazing movie that would be.
No, I'm going to stick with the, I say like give Villeneuve his opportunity to complete his own film.
All right.
Instead. And if you want to hear more about the Colin's thoughts on the the 1984 version, please see our earlier Dune podcast. And otherwise, we'll say, this is the Real DMC Podcast, signing off. Bye, everybody.
Goodbye, everybody. Goodbye. Bye.
Every time I hear Kwisatz Haderach, I want to say, give the dog a bone.
Me too, actually.
Seriously.
With Kwisatz Haderach, give the dog a bone. This old worm came sliding home. Lean in a little close to the mic if you can, like right about here.
Okay.
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 All right. I'm just going to launch into it. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Real DMC Podcast. DMC stands for Dave, Marks, and Colin. Today, it's actually the Real DM Podcast because I am here with Dave's mom. Dave's mom, I'd like to welcome you to the podcast. How are you doing?
Oh, thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Is this your first podcast?
Yes, it is.
Okay. We recently watched the movie Dune, and I understand that you also recently watched the movie Dune. So I just wanted to ask you a couple quick questions about that. How does that sound?
Oh, it sounds just fantastic. I can't believe. I'm so excited, and I don't remember a thing, but that's okay.
Okay, well, that's all right. Well, let me ask you this. So why did you watch the movie in the first place?
Because we were looking for something to see on TV, and we clamped onto that movie.
And what did you know of Dune before you watched it?
I knew nothing about it. I did remember that I did give you the book to read when you were young.
13, I think, yeah.
13? Okay, 13. Yeah. Okay. I didn't read it.
Yeah, you guys gave me a set of four books, actually.
Actually, so. Was it four books?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You sent me a text during the movie, I think, yeah, in the middle of the movie, and you said, we're trying to watch Dune, ... it's not going well. So tell me about your viewing experience.
Well, no, the problem was I didn't remember anything from previous, so it was jumping into an unknown territory, and it was very difficult to get the gist of what was going on.
Okay, and that's actually one of the reasons why I'm curious to talk to you, because I have a theory that if you know the material, the movie's great, and if you don't know the material, I'm kind of curious to see what you learned from it, or what you were able to figure out, I guess.
Okay. To me, what I remember about it, it was two different families or factions fighting against each other for control of spice, which eventually, I guess, it allowed you to travel. It allowed you to take over this big desert area mm-hmm. and be the supreme beings, I guess. What I remember is that there were big worms
uh-huh.
that ate people that eventually produced the spice.
Okay.
And I don't know how on earth they named it spice.
Okay, well, okay. So let me ask this just in general. What did you like about the movie?
Not much.
Okay. What didn't you like about the movie?
It was confusing. Honestly, I think I'll stick with my Marvel characters and Star Wars, and Mars with Matt Damon.
The Martian?
The Martian.
The Martian.
The Martian. Yeah. I think that's my level of expertise in sci-fi.
Okay. So let me just ask you just a couple quick questions.
Okay.
Who is Paul Atreides? And what is his journey or what is his motivation?
Oh, Paul, I think they tested him. He was like going to be the supreme being, if
right.
I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And they put him through a test of extreme pain. Does that sound right?
Yeah.
And then he passed that. And then he could drink this fluid that would allow him to be strong. It would... and around for life, forever, maybe. Okay, yeah, is that about right?
The water of life, they didn't even get to that in this movie.
The water of life. Oh, they didn't. That was what I read on my phone in preparation for this podcast.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think you cheated just a little bit, honestly.
I had to get up early and study.
Okay. Okay, so who are the Harkonnens?
I think they're the bad ones.
Okay.
They were the ones who were trying to take over this land and spice, and they were the enemy.
Okay, yeah, you got it. Who are the Fremen?
Those were the good guys.
Okay.
That's what I think. Those were the good guys that wanted to maintain life and a better, they just wanted to, yeah, they were going to take the colony and do good things.
Okay. I'm actually, you're crushing this, I got to be honest. I'm very surprised. Okay, let me ask you a couple of harder ones then.
Go.
Okay. Who are the Bene Gesserit and what is their objective?
I don't remember. They were destroyed, weren't they?
No, so the Bene Gesserit was the woman that came in to test Paul. So she was a member of the Bene Gesserit.
Okay, right. And didn't she die?
No, not yet.
Not yet.
No.
Next movie?
Yes.
Okay.
Spoiler alert. Okay.
Okay.
So you talked about this before, but what is the spice and what is it used for?
It's used for extraterrestrial. You can move in space.
Right.
From place to place to place, or planet to planet to planet. And also, I think that it has a factor for health and longevity.
Yeah, you actually got a lot out of this movie.
I just don't remember a thing.
All right.
Okay.
What?
Except it was very dreary.
A little dreary?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. It was definitely dreary.
Okay. What is Shai Hulud?
I have not a clue.
Okay. That's the Fremen name for the sandworm. That's what they call the sandworm.
Oh, is that the sandworm?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you got to look out for them because they'll eat you.
Yes, they will, actually.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
How about this? What is a thumper?
Oh, come on. I have not a clue.
Thumper is that thing that they put in the sand that was pounding, and then it makes the sandworm go towards it based on vibrations.
Oh, I do remember that.
Yeah.
Okay, but why would you want them to come to you?
Well, you use that to distract them, to try to pull them away from you, so somebody
okay, so somebody else doesn't get eaten.
Yeah.
Okay, I got it.
Okay, well...
I'm sorry. That's all I remember.
No, I thought you've done a great job. I'm super impressed. Actually, here you go. One last question.
Oh, no.
What is the Kwisatz Haderach?
Oh, come on. Stop it.
What is the Kwisatz Haderach?
I have not a clue.
Okay, well, that is actually the name for the Supreme Being that you referenced earlier. So.
Oh.
Yeah, so you kind of got it, so...
Okay.
Yeah.
He's your go-to guy then? Is that it?
Well, he becomes... So Paul eventually becomes the Kwisatz Haderach.
Yeah. Okay. Could you say that word again?
Kwisatz Haderach.
Okay.
And I'm probably mispronouncing it as well. Whatever.
Okay. Well, this has been a great experience.
Well, let me ask you one last question.
No, that's not fair. You've now said that three times.
Okay. Well, then I have one more question for you. They are going to make a sequel. Are you going to watch the sequel?
No.
No. Okay. All right.
No, I have absolutely no desire to watch the sequel.
Okay. And then how about just...
Except that I'll bet if I watched the sequel, I would have a better understanding because then I would have had this particular movie as a basis for a foundation
right.
to understand. So I would, if I watched the sequel, I would try to go back and watch
that's
Dune.
That's not to tap the table next to the microphone. That's okay. I know it's your first podcast.
Okay, I'm only doing this because of you.
Well, I figured as much, yeah.
Okay.
Unless was somebody else coming to ask you to be on podcasts and you turning them down?
I did. Oh, yeah, I'm very popular.
Okay, good. All right.
Okay.
All right, well, any closing thoughts about Dune that you'd like to say?
I wouldn't suggest it to your audience to watch.
Okay, well, you and I are going to have different opinions on this pod, so.
We got it.
Okay.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, Mom, it was great to have you on the podcast. Okay. Thank you. Okay.
Bye.
Goodbye, everybody.
Bye. God. Oh, my God.
I'm going to have to ask Dad to stop moving drawers and stuff just for a couple minutes. That's okay.
Sure.
Can you stop moving drawers and
just be quiet.
Just for a few minutes.
Don't make any noise.
Thank you.